Come knock on our door.
Come knock on our door.
We've been waiting for you. The kisses are hers and hers and his. Dreams company too. Come and dance on our floor.
Come and dance on our floor.
Take a step that is new.
Take a step that is new.
We've a lovable space that needs your face. Dreams company too. You'll see that life is a ball again. Laughter is calling for you. Down at our rendezvous.
Down at our rendezvous.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Are you awake?
Yeah, I am. It's roll the clocks forward, damn it.
Yes, we're springing forward into the past here on Geek Crunch Retrocast.
That's right.
Yeah, it's not one of my favorite days of the year.
Yeah, I like it lighter in the morning than I do at night, because I usually get out in the dark anyway, so.
Yeah. No, once the adjustment takes place, it's pretty good, but today, I always, all day long, I'll be looking at the clock thinking it's earlier than it is.
Well, yeah. I always look at the clock and think that, because it usually takes us a couple days to change the big clock in our living room. It's like really vaulted. You have to pull out the ladder.
Oh, yeah. Actually take some, yeah, I'm spoiled nowadays because everything, a lot of stuff updates automatically. You know, I mean, my phone and the computer and stuff, that the things that I look at the most often for the time.
Yeah.
But I got a little clock in here that I have to change. It's just, you know, a normal plugged into the wall clock. No internet.
So how are you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good weekend. It's actually gonna be oddly warm today. It's already 50 degrees out. Supposed to get a little warmer this afternoon even.
Yeah, we had a really cold day yesterday, but it's supposed to heat up this week.
Yeah, yesterday was pretty, I think it got to about 50 in the afternoon yesterday too. It's been a funny winter because a lot of the big snowstorms and stuff have, I mean, you guys got it out there and it's been, you know, hitting the Midwest and it hit the East Coast and stuff. But, you know, we're supposedly known for tons of snow here and we actually haven't really been the ones that gotten hit. And even the snow in the area, is it hit more up along like Niagara Falls and the you know, Erie Lake and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So been kind of strange.
Yeah, even yesterday it was so damn cold. I was like, I'm going to walk Harley before it gets really cold. Or just take her for a short one because it was already snowing. And it was windy. And that when the wind is there, that makes it like really worse. Because
oh, yeah,
it's like
definitely.
If it's 30, it's wind chill, you know, drops it to 20 or something.
Yeah.
And I was just going to take her for a short one, but she fell down at the base of the path and said, let's go the whole way. Like she was like, she wouldn't move. Like, I'm not turning around. We're going all the way. So it was freezing, man.
Yeah. The wind makes a big difference. Definitely. I can deal with the cold, but when it's the wind that really, when it's blasting you in the face, just makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, Karen, I like when it warms up, but Luna's, she's like, she's not as excited. She likes the cold. She likes when it's snow on the ground. I took her for a walk this morning, and there's just like, as I walk up and down the street, there's a couple little patches of snow still sitting there, you know, just when it's warmed up a lot, but the higher banks or whatever they were at the time, there's just a little bit of snow left, and it's mostly, it's not good. It's just mostly frozen over and stuff. She's still trying to dig her snout down into it.
Yeah.
She loves to do it, the snowbanks and stuff. And like, I don't think that's happening there. She tried.
Yeah. All right. So this is Geek Brunch Retrocast episode 8. Or no, it's 9. Excuse me. Good Lord.
9.
Can't
number
even get 9. The number right.
Number 9.
I can't get the numbers right on any of the shows. I I posted DC Noise 108 last night. It's 208. I'm like off 100 episodes.
Yeah, I saw that. I almost made a comment like maybe you guys are time traveling.
I don't know why I keep doing that. I mean, I have it in my notes. I just know what's going on. Getting old, I guess. Going back in time.
That sounds more like around what regular Geek Brunch is at.
No, we're almost at 200 now. We're right at 177.
But that's a little closer. Like if you were 180 something, it's closer for that
it's
podcast.
Just because it's every other week mostly.
Yeah. Too many shows to keep track of, Mike.
All right, so I thought we'd start off with some questions. So we have some questions.
Okay.
And then we'll jump into some comics.
Sounds good.
Let me see here if I can find everything. I'm not so ill prepared. All right. On Facebook, I asked if there were any retrocast questions, and we got a couple. Keith Knutson from our co-host from DC Noise is, if you can ask Kirby one question, what would it be? You only get one.
Yeah, I had the benefit of seeing that he asked that, so I got a chance to think about it, because I'm glad I did, because it took me a little while to think of, sort of narrow it down. But I think if I had a chance to ask him one question, I'd say, Mr. Kirby, of course, given all the characters that you've created and the stories that you've done for Marvel and DC and other companies, and you know, some of those that you did by yourself, some of them you collaborated with others, what would you say is the one that most represents pure Kirby? In other words, like, what would you say is the thing that you created that was most directly from you and nobody, you know, no other person's ideas incorporated there? So maybe it would be the same as whatever it would be his favorite, but it's kind of like trying to phrase it a little bit differently than what would be his favorite.
You know what's hard, though, to ask those questions? Like, that would be the question I'd want to know, too, personally.
Yeah.
But you know what's hard to, even when you get asked these questions as a podcaster and stuff, it's hard to answer because everything's a function of time. And I think you're going to say what you remembered most liking. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just going to be hard.
Yeah.
Because he's created so much.
No, I know. It would be a tough question.
Good Lord.
I mean, the other thing I thought was just maybe I would say, Mr. Kirby, there's this guy that's bothering me at school, and I was wondering if you could take care of him for me. Would you mind kicking his ass?
Yeah. I think I would ask him more like what it was like growing up as a kid, because I'd want to know more like what made him what he is, what he became to be, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
And hopefully the answer would last a long time, because either right. that or can I move in with you?
Yeah. No, take your time answering.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
That'd be awesome if he was still around. I could say, oh, come stay out here. I'll pay for your week out here. There's certain things. Like, I was very tempted to... We did a Kickstarter thing with Danny Trejo, like his son's doing a movie. Uh-huh. And in that movie, you could kickstart it for $5,000. I was so tempted, and Danny Trejo would kick your ass on film. He'd kill you on film.
Oh, nice.
It's like, that'd be awesome, but you really have to probably fly out to where they're filming it. It'd cost hotel.
That's true. So I wonder, you know, how much it would end up costing you in the end.
Yeah,
but that'd be it would definitely be something you remember for the rest of your life, that's for sure. That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, my question, I'd like to hear the answer to yours, but since you've already asked it, I'd like to find more about his childhood, I guess. Any of his memories, you know, childhood memories that he remembers anyway.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I have a feeling it would be, I mean, I know even with, you know, with my own grandparents and stuff, asking them questions, things that they remember. You know, my grandpa, my mom's dad was alive, and I got to talk to him one time about his memories from being in the Korean War and stuff. And it's just so fascinating, you know, when you get that first person account. So, I mean, that would be, it would be really, really cool. In addition to hearing about, like, if, you know, if you got the chance to just spend an afternoon with him or something, to hear about his experiences in the war and stuff from first person, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Perspective and everything, but be really fascinating from a historical perspective.
Or like what he used to do for fun, you know, geek-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, because,
you know, that'd be cool to know.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I liked learning. Also, speaking of him being in the war, was just that story about how, you know, they found out that he was an artist, and that actually, you know, you'd think maybe he had a talent, so maybe he would be put into a safer circumstance, but he actually got, you know, a lot of times when you hear about famous people being in the war, in different wars and stuff like that, they maybe, you know, were stationed somewhere or something like that, where things were a little safer if they were, you know, if they ended up surviving. But he was actually recruited to be a scout because of his drawing abilities, and that was actually one of the most dangerous things that you could do.
Yeah, because you have to be there at the front line, I would imagine.
Yeah, we kind of go in, and he would go in and draw. The layout of the land and troop positions and stuff like that.
They didn't have technology like we did today, you know, where you could do it from satellite.
No. Nope.
You had to go draw it.
Yeah.
He was probably the best for it, too, because he had to be fast. He had to be a fast guesser.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that was one of the things. That was something that came up when I was doing a little bit more reading of that Tales to Astonish book this week, was how they were constantly getting Kirby to train artists when they were bringing in new artists to Marvel. And, you know, they were encouraged to kind of take the Kirby approach to at least, like, if not in style.
And speed.
and layout and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And hopefully speed, but and even Kirby himself, I forget which artist it was, kind of got where he really had kind of incorporated the lessons Kirby had given him on page layout and, you know, dynamic poses and stuff like that. Said, okay, good job. Now get to where you can do that three times as fast or something like that.
Back then, I bet it was more paycheck, though, the more you could do, so.
Yeah. That was the motivation.
Yeah. I don't know what his lifestyle was, like, if he was well, his income. It would be nice to know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was as rich as Stan, I'll tell you that. Just seeing pictures and stuff.
Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say he didn't get as much as he probably deserved.
Mm-hmm. Because back then, if a writer got paid the same as an artist, oh my god.
Then, unfortunately, it sounds like.
Because an artist, I mean, God bless the writers, but the artist has to spend more time rendering the story.
Yeah, well, that's why some artists have switched over and write. I mean, I think even David Laffam has said as much, that the reason he writes a lot more often than he does art is just from a practical perspective, is he can make more money that way.
Yeah. You know?
But
His art has been showing up, but it's just like one shots now.
Yeah.
Mostly know him more for his writing now, because he's an Avatar.
Yeah.
All right, so the next question is from Vicious Smith or Ken. It says, what Bat family death of all time impacted you the most? It's tough for me.
Yeah.
Because deaths impact me for about a day and then I'm okay again. But
has that always been the case when you were younger?
Yeah, because even at the Silver Age, characters would die and then the next issue they'd be back. There'd be like a, oh, this is how they got out of it.
So you're already.
I guess it would be Jason Todd.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember, though, what I called in for. I don't remember if I called in for him to die or if I called him for. I know I did call to vote. I think I called for him to live because I always liked Jason Todd. I liked him because he was, I don't know, an angry. He was like the Damien of that time.
Yeah.
He has attitude and like one of the fondest memories I remember of Jason is when he, you know, they did that Lethal Weapon type story where the guy was like, ooh, diplomatic immunity, you can't do anything to me. And then the next thing, Batman comes and the guy is splattered on the floor because he's like pushed out the window. all he sees is Robin's, you know, Jason swinging away, you know? You're like, what happened? You know what happened. He threw him out the window. But, I guess that was the biggest impact at the time. And, God, there's so many I could answer. I didn't like when Spoiler died or you know, Stephanie Brown.
Yeah.
And then they made matters worse when they said it. Leslie Thompson or Adoption was part of it. I'm like, no. I hated that part of the story, but that was rough.
I think that left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth.
Yeah. Flash, when he died in Crisis on Infinite Earths, that was kind of big because I was a huge Barry Allen fan at the time.
Yeah, I'm trying to think because, as I've said, I didn't really grow up reading much Batman. I mean, what DC I read was Batman, which was only a few issues. I didn't read Death in the Family until later on as an adult. Still, you know, and I still found it to be a pretty powerful story, pretty brutal. You know, when Joker does the act, but by that point, I think by that point, when I read it, Jason Todd was already back. But so I'm trying to think, you know, what other deaths specifically in the Bat family. I mean, like you said, Stephanie Brown. I mean, that whole thing just kind of seemed a little cheap in some ways. And I'm trying to think if, other than the most recent, if there's other ones that were significant within the Bat family.
Not a death, but one that impacted me a lot was when Joker shot Barbara and crippled her.
Yeah.
The Killing Joke. That one impacted me a lot. She didn't die, but that was pretty crazy.
In some ways, I probably would have to say Damien, because, you know, it's hard to get emotionally impacted by the actual death in, you know, modern big two superhero comics, but just the whole fact that, you know, the character, being that he's literally, it's not just a, you know, sort of a metaphorical father-son relationship, given the fact that he literally is Bruce's son and literally a child, you know, in the way that the way that it was used for publicity, I think, even though it's a fictional story, the way that DC sort of seemed to seek publicity and attention to the comic, and it, even though it's fictional, it's a fictional child, it's still publicity over killing a child.
10 years old, or roughly.
Yeah, it's still kind of. I mean, I'm not judging the quality of the story, and I'm not necessarily pointing the finger at anyone, but I haven't ultimately come down to how I feel about everything, but I would say that it has impacted me in a kind of negative way so far. It's leaving me a little sour taste in my mouth in terms of the whole hullabaloo around it, you know?
Yeah. It was upsetting to me, but more so because I found out about his death before I read it. So, like, when I was reading the Batman stories about the relationship between them growing and the annual and stuff, and
yeah,
all the cool stuff, that impacted me more than the actual death because I knew he had died.
Yeah.
So that was rough.
But, I sort of like the idea that Daryl Taylor had come up with and talked about in that DC Noise episode. That
I don't like any ideas that he comes up with.
Maybe it was ultimately that Damian would sort of take over a League of Shadows and stuff, or the League of Assassins. Which is kind of interesting, but. So yeah, I don't know. So I guess if I had to choose, just because I didn't read about Jason Todd growing up and everything, I guess I'd have to go with Damian.
Yeah, it's hard to think of everybody that died because everybody was back. Well, Azrael died and he didn't come back.
Mm.
He was part of the Bat family.
That's true.
Bruce Wayne died in Earth 2.
Yeah. I guess he kind of sort of was thought to be dead.
Yeah.
Lost in time, or whatever it was.
All right, so that's that question. And it says, the next one is, if you had 130... I'm not going to be able to answer this, but if you had 135 command points... Who would you spend it on? Captain Britain, Psylocke, Deadpool, Cable, or Wasp?
Well, you could just answer it out of your lack of knowledge.
Well, I'll base it on characters.
Right. Who asked that one?
This is from Ken, Vicious Smith.
Oh, that was him for two. Okay.
Personally, I don't have a bond with any of those characters. I've kind of grown to like Cable a little bit.
Yeah.
Especially when LeDron was drawing it because it looked Kirby. But I would go with the Wasp because, I don't know, she's small and she could get in your ear and mess you up. She could make your equilibrium go to hell.
Who are the, it was Captain Britain, Psylocke, Cable, Wasp, and who else?
Deadpool.
Oh, Deadpool. Well, I was playing Avengers Alliance, and I stopped because I haven't played it in a couple weeks because my job, I'm on the computer all day, and like so I've been trying to just to not play games on the computer anymore and not really use the computer except for on the weekends because it was actually starting to bother my arms and stuff like that.
Yeah,
just being on the computer all the time. So I stopped playing it, but probably Psylocke would be the best one to go with from what I've seen. I didn't have her, but people seem to like her a lot.
Yeah, if you're talking from a game perspective, I guess she's pretty powerful too.
Yeah, she is pretty powerful the way they made her, but they can always change those things. But
I'm going more with likability. I don't like Deadpool.
No.
He's probably pretty good because you can't really kill him. He's like Wolverine.
He's pretty good. They made him kind of consistent with the comics where he breaks the fourth wall
Yeah.
And, like, talks to you directly as a player. And he, like, he'll pull out a little laptop during the battle and, like, hack the game. Or he'll, like, do, like, a Facebook like on one of the random characters. It could be, like, one of yours or one of the enemies.
Yeah.
So he's kind of unpredictable, so they made him that way. But if I base this just on characters, I think I'd go with Wasp, too, because I like Wasp the best out of those characters, I think.
Yeah, I've always liked her. So now that I'm reading some of her older stuff, I like her even more.
Yeah.
Okay, the last question from this group is if you were a Cartoon Network exec and had to make one of the DC shorts into a series, would you choose Amethyst or Black Lightning and Family? I haven't seen the Black Lightning and Family one, but I have seen the Amethyst, and as much as I like Amethyst, I hated that short rendition of it. It was too, like, anime and goofy. I didn't like it.
I haven't seen either of those, but
I choose Black Lightning and Family. But if it was based on the comic Sword and Sorcery, I would have liked to see an Amethyst.
Well, if it depends, like, if I was going off of what I personally would like to see, I would go with Black Lightning. But if I was in just an exec who was trying to make the most money, without seeing the Amethyst one that they did, I would probably do something with the Amethyst property and try to turn it into like a
money maker.
Yeah, a popular phenomenon, like with young girls or whatever.
That's a good answer. It's all about the money.
Yeah.
If I was an exec, it's all about the money. So
yeah.
I'm not going to go with what I like, but with what I think is going to make more money.
Right.
Oh, that's a good answer.
Yeah.
I'd be a terrible exec then, not in this industry.
Yeah, you really have to divorce yourself from like what you as a fan like.
Yeah.
Probably. But, yeah, me personally, though, I would rather see Black Lightning and Family show. That would be awesome.
All right, just a few more. This is from Diane E. at Diane Thrax. She asks, can a lightsaber cut through adamantium? I would think so. I've never seen it not slice anything.
Hmm.
It might take longer. Like, you know how in Attack of the Clones or any of those movies where they have to cut through a door that is really, really thick?
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while.
I'm going to say, I'll go with the opposite answer, not just to be opposite, but I'm going to go with no. If you put them in the same universe, I think lightsabers are too common. It's almost like if like swords could cut through adamantium in this universe, mm-hmm. then you would like have like any old like. And like any.
Wait! What universe are you in? Are you in the Star Wars universe or are you in the Marvel universe?
I'm in the Star Marvel universe.
Star Marvel universe.
I'm in the hybrid universe created by the two of them smashed together. That's what I'm thinking. Like,
okay.
So Marvel won't want Wolverine to be able to smash up, get like decapitated by any old Jedi that comes along. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe I still have my executive hat on. I'm like, what? You can have Wolverine chopped up by any old Jedi that comes along.
There's a lot of Jedi around.
Yeah.
There's a lot of leftover. There's a lot of dead Jedi around with lightsabers that are still out there.
Maybe in like episode 7, like Mark Hamill will chop Hugh Jackman's head off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think a lightsaber could cut through adamantium.
All right, so the next question is, this is kind of a retro question and kind of a modern question. Where does Superman change now that everyone has a cell phone and there's no...
That's a pretty good question, actually.
I think he just runs and changes while he's moving.
Ah. He has to hop at super speed to get his pant legs on?
Yeah, even Christopher Reeve did that. Like, I think even in the movie they made fun of the phone booth because at that time they would make those phone booths, but they wouldn't have the glass enclosings. It would just be like the phone hanging.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I remember one scene in one of the Supermans where Clark was looking for a phone booth, and he turns and looks, and it's one of those open phones. And
he
says, okay, I'll run down the alleyway and just change.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree that that's probably the case, but if there was some kind of, like, Kryptonian stipulation that he had to consistently change into Superman and in a certain kind of spot in Metropolis, I think he probably could choose, like, Starbucks bathrooms.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Starbucks.
Still closets. He's done that even in the Silver Age.
Went into
the closet of the Daily Planet.
Yeah.
And there are closets in a cubicle.
Subway station.
I have an office. Yeah. Okay, this one you might have to answer because I don't know much Harry Potter, but why don't Harry Potter's glasses fall off more?
Hmm.
I think it's because he has a sports band in the back and you just can't see it.
I think it's because Hermione cast a spell on them so they would stay on.
That's a good one. That's a better one than the sports.
She's a good friend like that.
And the other one I'm going to save for the other Geek Brunch because they were modern questions.
Okay.
What brunch? This is from Olokin Prime. What brunch item goes well with reading comics in the morning? I guess when you're reading comics, what do you like to eat or drink?
Bloody Marys. You gotta have coffee.
I never had a Bloody Mary. What's in a Bloody Mary besides the tomato juice?
It's tomato juice. Vodka is the alcohol. And it depends, like, traditionally, it'll have, like, tobacco sauce.
That sounds terrible.
It's so good. It have, like, a little bit of Worcestershire sauce.
Oh, God. It sounds like some drunk dude is just throwing stuff in a vodka.
It's a hangover cure.
Let's go. Morning drink, or is it a...
Yeah. Yeah, they're usually... I mean, you can have them anytime, but...
What do they call that orange juice with the liquor in it? What is that? Sometimes they serve that for breakfast.
Orange juice and champagne is a mimosa.
Mimosa, there you go.
Bloody Mary also, like, a lot of times they'll have horseradish in them.
God, that sounds horrible.
Lemon juice, and they'll usually, like, garnish it with, like, celery and, like, an olive and... some black pepper in there and stuff. I just had one yesterday.
As you were reading your comics?
Yeah. No, it was between lunch and dinner. And I had a Bloody Mary. But I've made them before. Actually, we had...
What did yours that you had yesterday have in it? I mean, can you taste the Tabasco and...
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I don't know if it had any horseradish in it. It depends. And there's lots of variations, just like any alcoholic drink. I think the place we had them, I think they put, like, celery salt in it. Something a little bit different. But, you know, they're usually spicy. I like spicy stuff. But so do you, and it doesn't sound good, so.
Well, it doesn't sound good in vodka. Like, all that stuff, Worcester sauce, I like.
Mm-hmm.
I love Tabasco sauce. Horseradish, I like a lot. I didn't used to, but I've grown accustomed to like it a lot, especially like prime rib or some kind of roast beef or something.
Yeah.
So I like all those ingredients. I just don't want them in a drink. I don't want to drink it.
Well, it only, like, the horseradish only has a little bit of it. And the vodka, you know, I mean, there's such strong flavors in there. You don't taste the vodka really in a real strong way. Because vodka, I mean, I don't mind vodka, but vodka is probably my least favorite alcohol. But,
really?
I guess it's probably an acquired taste.
That one likes that.
She likes vodka?
Yeah. I don't like any kind of liquor that is like a hard liquor.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I can't taste it, my stomach tastes it later.
Yeah. I like gin. I like whiskey. I guess I like all
that's more more tasteful, isn't it? Because vodka, you can't, is sometimes not very tasteful. Unless you have something in it.
It's not really a sipping alcohol. Like, people sip bourbon, stuff like that, just on the rocks. But I think Russians are the only one that drink, like, vodka straight.
Mm. All right. That's the questions we had. Thank you for giving us questions.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. I wasn't expecting that many. That's pretty cool. Maybe I'll make a picture of Bloody Mary's when we have an anniversary episode.
Maybe we'll have one if you go to Baltimore.
Yeah.
Baltimore Con, we'll have one at the breakfast.
You can get
Tabasco on his eggs, we'll order a Bloody Mary.
Yeah, like, give me some of that Tabasco for my Bloody Mary.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't want it, and you could get a virgin one if you don't want the... you could get it without vodka.
Yeah.
So you could just have tomato juice
like
with a lot of spice.
I would like to taste it. I don't think I would like it.
Yeah.
I hate to buy stuff unless I could try it.
Yeah. It does sound weird. I don't remember when I first had one, but I used to think tomato juice was disgusting. I know that, but I kind of came around to it.
All right. So, do you want to jump in? I'll let you pick this time. Do you want to jump into the Fourth World Omnibus or to the miscellaneous?
I was thinking we could start with Kirby because I feel like, yeah, we didn't do that last time.
Sure.
Switch it up. I mean, they got it. I mean, how long can you wait to talk about Transylvania?
That was very weird.
It was very weird. So we had two issues of Jimmy Olsen this time in a row, issues 142 and 143, and it's basically a two-part story, actually, it turned out to be. They're pretty weird. Like I said last time, you know it going in because there's a big old vampire on the cover and a wolf man grabbing Jimmy Olsen.
This issue 142 of Superman's Pal, 142 and 143.
Yeah. 142 is called The Man from Transylvania, as opposed to Transylvania. And, you know, throughout these issues, there's definitely a lot of, he's playing with a lot of the motifs and, like, the Universal classic monsters. Especially Dracula and the Wolfman, but he's not called Dracula. He's called, I gotta find his name here. Something weird. Drago something?
Yeah, that's his. He called himself Count Dragorin.
Dragorin, yeah.
Dragorin from Transylvania.
Yeah.
And this vampire is pretty crazy because he could, like, bite somebody from miles and miles away. And he bites him through his eyes.
Yeah, it starts off, he's got yellow glowing eyes, and And yeah, from miles away, it's this yellow beam that goes all the way into the neck and creates what looks like bite marks on the neck of Laura Conway, the woman that we've seen before, who's Morgan Edge's secretary, the one that Don Rickles hit on.
Yeah, she's an interesting character. I like her.
Yeah. So in addition to giving her sharp canines, she also, the vampire bite also causes her to really overdo it on eyeliner and mascara.
It makes her eyebrows really creepy looking.
Yeah, her eyebrows also get really huge. So, but it doesn't seem, so it's not a permanent condition, though. I was surprised to find out that she doesn't turn to a vampire permanently.
And she's not opposed to sunlight, like, she's out in the day working.
Yeah, yeah, she comes to work and everything else. She's on the phone doing her job and everything.
Yeah, and Clark and Jimmy just want to talk to Morgan. They just want to give him shit for all the stuff he's been doing. And she's like, I don't even know where Morgan is. And then she passes out and they see the bite marks. And then Clark is holding her
in
his arms and he looks in a mirror and she's not there.
Yeah. So he's just holding his hands out in front of him. Or it appears to be the case. I did like the subplot throughout these two issues, though, with the with their young group of adventurers. We got Scrapper and Flipper Dipper, and Scrapper has been carrying around.
I love that.
His one of his doubles, one of his little mini Scrapper Troopers. He's basically taken him on as like a little pet, a miniaturized version of himself in an army helmet. And so the Newsboys, they're underwater, they're in a ship, and so this obviously gives Flipper Dipper an opportunity to use his special skills.
Well, they're actually trying to escape where they've been confined to. Like, they want to get back to where Guardian and Clark are, or Superman.
Right, because members of the inner gang that had trapped them, right?
Yeah.
I believe.
Well, I thought they couldn't get out because they were confined because they were sick. Like, they had the flu or something.
Yeah, but I think that they had a...
Oh, they did get out, and then inner gang. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That was in the last issue. I forgot.
Yeah. Especially... I mean, we do them two weeks in between, but then sometimes we don't even get an issue of one of the four series. So sometimes it's even longer than that, you know, because each series kind of has its own storyline. But Clark doesn't really get a chance to turn into Superman yet, him and Jimmy end up running. You know, they go to a research center. That's basically, Clark says it was a lot more active in the 50s, pretty much abandoned now. And when they get there, they're attacked by a dude that looks like the Wolfman, with like a huge, huge pompadour. His hair's pretty wild. Looks like he moosed it up in addition to... He almost looks like a lion at times, more than a wolf.
Yeah, I just want to say before that, they've confronted Count... The count showed up where that secretary was.
Right.
Blasted them with his eye beams and knocked them unconscious. And then Clark attacks him and he turns into a puff of smoke. And then they end up at the research center.
Right. Yeah. So they had that encounter with them. And that's kind of what leads them to, you know, to head out and to try to investigate the whole situation further. And yes, Clark finally gets a chance to turn into Superman, but not before Jimmy attacks
werewolf.
He rips off. There's a steel fence nearby, so he rips the steel fence post off, and attacks the Wolfman with a.
With I thought a, it was gonna. I thought, you know, when I first read that, I thought it was gonna be a silver post, like so. You know how werewolves don't like silver.
Oh right, yes.
Yeah. He jammed it in his chest, and it didn't do much. It just pissed him off.
Yeah, it gets him off because Clark's trying not to, you know, act super powered, so he's actually kind of letting the Wolfman take him down. And Jimmy actually, thinks he's saving him pretty much. But, yeah, that fence post is that's a pretty dangerous fence because that fence post looks like, he looks like he's got Big Barda's mega rod or something in his hand.
And it's huge.
Yeah, it's pretty damn big. Pretty damn big fence.
You think it would have done some damage to the werewolf, but because he clobbered him in that one panel, and then he's swinging at him, and then he's running for his life, and he basically runs into Superman's chest and knocks himself unconscious, and then Superman takes the werewolf and just spins him, and like he just spins him as he's all dizzy and he passes out.
Yeah, he spins him like an airplane propeller. It's pretty awesome.
Now, blasts him, knocks him out again.
Yeah. Yeah, I get like kind of, I guess the werewolf, his name is Lupek, it looks like. So it's probably like Kirby kind of probably, you know, because you call it Lupine.
Yeah.
Kind of a shortened version of that. But yeah, he basically blinds them so that the two of them can escape. So Jimmy and Clark head into the factory. Or the research center, rather, and you know, they start finding machines and like that have been beat up and broken, and desks that have been ransacked, looking for information. And
on Dabney Donovan,
yeah, they discover it's a
very corrupt scientist.
Yeah, so Superman says that he's the closest thing to a mad scientist that they have. So I guess he has a connection to the DNA project, I guess. He's kind of like a rogue agent that was once with them, maybe, or something like that. I kind of got an impression.
And then Jack Kirby started taking drugs. This is the part of the... got weird. This was like a Grant Morrison thing, I think.
Yeah.
The story just flipped itself.
Yeah, so they're not... So the place that they're coming from is called Transylvania, but it seems to be like a planet.
With Superman.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got like four protrusions off the top of it, it looks like. And Superman looks with his microscopic vision into a photograph to find a message. Bloodmore destruct date 1971, it says. So that sounds like familiar to them. Jimmy knows that it's a cemetery, I guess. An old cemetery that goes back all the way to colonial times.
Yeah, and it's got a mausoleum, and inside that mausoleum is the planet. And the planet, here's where it gets weird, is the planet has a bunch of cameras zoomed in on it, and I guess what this scientist was doing was showing them like old Universal horror movies.
Yeah.
So the people of the planet thought they were these werewolves and vampires.
And so they're
weird.
Yeah, they adapted.
What a crazy ass idea.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from. But yeah, right before that we get the newsboys. They arrive where they're going in the little boat. They're underneath Metropolis, and they find like a secret hideout of the guy that who reveals as he's talking on the phone as they arrive that he's the one that killed Jim Harper, the original Guardian. And he he's hiding out and he's scared because there's, you know, because the DNA Project cloned the Guardian and he's been seen in public, he thinks that actually Jim Harper's actually still alive, so he's freaking out. And that's kind of for this issue, first issue, that's kind of the last thing we see as far as that subplot.
We get a cool little backup story, which is like a behind the scenes of it's the Harry Secrets Revealed. And it shows, it gives you like the backstory of the Mountain of Judgment. And it like tells you what it's all about, like the technology and what it looks like and the noises it makes. It was pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, it is a pretty cool couple pages, just because that was such a crazy, wild creation, you know. And you know, that was in the very first storyline, so it's going back a little while. And before you see the Mountain of Judgment, the last thing you're expecting is this huge, like 10-wheel vehicle with a dragon sculpture on top of it.
Yeah.
So it's cool to get a little bit of.
And it even tells you how big it is, because it shows a car next to it, so it's actual size. I've seen a comparison to a car.
Yeah, the car is basically the size of, it's about as long as one of its wheels and only as high as, you know, the hubcap. So it's pretty damn big.
Scrapper's my favorite Newsboy Legion guy. I dig him.
Yeah, he's pretty awesome.
Who's the other guy that's there? I can't remember. The one that looks like just like he's a straight man or whatever. Because you got Brainy and then the other Newsboy Legion, and you have that one guy hanging out with them.
Do you mean the one that's got like the purple jacket?
Yeah, I think so.
That's... Well, there's Big Words, Scrapper, Gabby...
Yeah, I know all those because they're... They distinctively look not normal. And then there's this one guy that's kind of like, you know, if you had Abbott Costello, he's kind of like Costello.
Yeah, he's
like... Or Abbott. I always get them confused because he's always, Abbott!
Let me see. Tommy Tompkins.
Oh, okay.
That's the original.
So, what, one of the original guys?
Well, you know how like there's the original that are now their parents?
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's just Tom Jr., I guess.
Hmm.
He's kind of like the leader, sort of.
So. He just doesn't seem to have many words. Do you know what I mean? It's always Brainy talking or Gabby because he's always talking. Or Scrapper.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't have much.
It's like in the background. For him being a leader, he doesn't really lead.
Probably kind of tough to lead.
Yeah. Everybody has their own agenda.
Yeah.
So that takes us into Superman's pal, the new Jimmy Olsen, 143, the Genocide Spray. And they had just gotten into the crypt and seen the creepy planet. Transylvania with the orbiting cameras around it, and you get a splash page with the huge planet again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this, you know, basically, like I said, it turns out to be basically a two-parter story. I like that, you know, we have the splash page that has the title on it, where they're finding a couple coffins, and on the one coffin is where the credits are, and it says, "In defiance of all the fears which have marked my human experience, I can't resist the gesture of placing our credits here." Edited, written, and drawn by Jack Kirby, asking the valued indulgence of Vince Coletta, who inks in funeral black. But yeah, keeping with the motif, they find Count Dragorin sleeping in the coffin, but typical Kirby fashion, it's more than what it seems that Superman observes that he's in a state of shock, and he's got metal gadgets near his head. So they do a little bit more investigation, and they realize that they're, even though they look like coffins, keeping with the theme of things, they're actually, they speculate that they're actually something called decompression chambers, just designed to look like coffins. But as they're sort of checking things out, the Wolfman attacks. As Jimmy's backing away, he backs right into a Frankenstein, rounding out the big trio of classic monsters.
The Count wakes up and knocks him out again. It's the third time.
Yeah, this time he uses a micro bomb.
Yeah.
Puts
him to sleep.
And he gives him a sleeping potion, yeah.
And then we cut to a scene with the Newsboy Legion, and this guy's on the phone basically with Inner Gang, and he said, this is a hideout. I want to stay here because I killed Jim Harper. That's all he could keep saying is, I killed Jim Harper. And then the Newsboy Legion introduced themselves, and he tries to grab for a gun, and they take the gun away from him, and they leave him in the chair, and he eventually just smashes the table in front of him and tries to escape. But Inner Gang ain't going to have that. They booby trap the hideout.
Kirby's indulging his love of like 50s crime capers and stuff for the guy with the way that the guy talks.
Yeah.
He keeps saying, "See, what's more, I like this hideout, see? It's like a stinking underground bunker, but I like it cuz it's safe, see?"
It's like a lot of different genres mixed into this story.
Oh yeah. That's Kirby for you.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty much this guy doesn't have much of a chance. You know.
Yeah, Inner Gang hits the button and
Inner Gang basically used him. But so yeah, if you ever wanted to see Superman tortured by classic monsters, this would be the issue for you to pick up.
Yeah, and they introduced a mummy and a vampire woman too.
Yep. Yep.
Vampira.
Lady Dracula. But yeah, they actually have Superman tied down with ropes, however that works, and they got this torture contraption that's... Superman's basically... I mean, he's passed out, but when he wakes up, he's just kind of going along with things to find out stuff.
The part I had a hard time with the story is the Count is seeking out this Donovan guy, like, to get revenge for him capturing him and showing him these movies. Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, this is kind of where things change, sort of shift gears, because the monsters, Dragorn and the other monsters, stop being the villains really at this point when, they don't really know how powerful Superman is, so Superman just smashes the torture device they have him in, and they realize that, they think he's a sorcerer, a hugely powerful wizard and stuff, and but basically to find out, these people in some ways are kind of the victims of Donovan, so Superman and Jimmy start to, for the rest of the issue, kind of work with them to help them out of their predicament of being these monsters or looking like these monsters. But before we finish that up, we go back to the Newsboy Legion, and they're like, basically they're having to find their way out of the rubble was created by the explosion.
Killing Jim Harper made him too hot, even for Inner Gang. And then he's like, hey, I forgot. I have one of these guys in my pocket.
Oh, yeah.
A scrapper trooper, and he's okay.
He's like, oh, shit, did he get squashed?
It's a little bit of humor, and then they find a grate on top of the building there, they climb a ladder, find a grate, and they almost get run over by a car because it's like a street grate.
Yeah, I like that. Like, Scrapper, basically, you could tell that he thinks he himself is pretty awesome. Like, he's got, because he's basically a huge fan of a little miniaturized version of himself. And I like that the mini Scrapper Trooper's pretty, you know, too small to actually speak and be heard. So he just kind of waves his helmet in the air to say he's okay.
Yeah, and he's not. The Scrapper Trooper did something early on. He's the one that pointed out where Flippa Dippa needed to get him to the, you know, get him out of that tunnel.
Yeah. So yeah, he's a valuable member of the team.
He's no joke. And then we cut to some weirdness with Superman fighting technology and beasts called demon dogs. And that the demon dog really isn't an organic thing. It's really a machine with a lot of guns and stuff in it.
Yeah, and they're pretty normal motif of Apocalypse, the demon dogs. We'll see them again soon. But yeah, the demon dogs are used by Dabney Donovan as kind of security and stuff.
This got weird. It's like, let's sit down and watch a movie.
Yeah, like the genocide spray is something that, so they kind of wash the planet clean or something like that, and they dismantle one of the demon dogs, and you see all the technology inside of it and stuff. But yeah, so typical Clark Kent, you know, Smallville strikes again. The movie that he changes to is Oklahoma. So
where did the monsters go, though?
They disappeared at one point, I think. In between,
did them taking out this technology return the planet? It's to be one complete orbital pass, then the genocide spray, the deadly rain that has washed the planet clean for new experiments. But I guess they just left the planet there, huh?
Yeah, and I guess the people went back. Because they do say that the fact that they turned into the monsters and stuff was because of a kind of a natural ability of those beings, so that's why Clark's Superman rather switches it to Oklahoma, so that they'll have a different film to
enjoy on their way home. Because they take off in those capsules, they say, "Holy halibut! It's like a squadron of coffins heading back to their home planet."
Yeah, no, it's good. They're actually going to. Yeah, here's where Superman says, "Those people are natural copiers. They have a fluid atomic base after generations of watching sky movies." So to them, it's like as if you looked up in the sky and there was a gigantic movie being like projected in the sky above you.
Yeah.
They became what they saw. So with changing the movie to Oklahoma,
they're going
to
be singing.
Yeah.
It's going to be terrible. I'm not a musical fan.
I'll bet they'd take real fine to good music. Some singing and dancing. Superman, I agree. That's why I chose the only musical Donovan had, a solid smash hit whenever it's played, Oklahoma. It's like, oh man, that sounds worse to me.
Yeah, I'd rather watch horror movies.
Yeah, so but their new culture now is so basically it's going to be based around Oklahoma, so it's going to be like a rural musical world. So that gives you somewhere to go on your next vacation, Mike.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go there to see these guys singing vampires and Frankenstein monsters singing Oklahoma.
Well, I imagine they'll probably look like Southerners by then.
Yeah, they don't
look like monsters anymore. But yeah, we have another couple page back.
I found this a weird, like a very weird thing to put here, because they went back to the DNA alien thing.
Yeah, this one seemed a little bit more like filler than the other one did.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. It just didn't really. It didn't really tell you much. Didn't really. It wasn't much new.
Yeah.
Just like a little event, but then we get Mr. Miracle 5, which this time around it definitely wasn't hard to pick a favorite. This was my favorite by far.
Yeah. Well, I think Mr. Miracle is by far my favorite. Not only do they introduce stuff, but I like the story much more in this one because I like Scott Free and Big Barda the best in Oberon.
Yeah.
Like they're characters that I love no matter when they're around. So maybe that's why they're my favorite. Mm-hmm. But we get a first appearance in this one too.
Yeah, again.
Dr. Wunderbar.
Wunderbar.
Murder's machine. He puts him through the car wash. Working at the car wash. I love this panel here where Big Bart is exercising in the front yard. And there's just a bunch of dudes there that are delivering a cannon and they're watching her. And they're like, oh my God, this chick is so hot to watch.
Yeah. They're just leaning on this little wall.
Yeah.
First we get a cannon and now a cutie. But yeah. This guy, Mr. Miracle, is just hilarious.
Yeah.
So Scott bought a genuine Civil War cannon, and that's what's being delivered. And you know, these fellas, these four guys, they've been hanging out, watching Barda exercise in her apocalyptic underwear, and you know, pretty macho guys. But you know, Civil War cannons like ridiculously heavy, and they're ready to show off for the sexy lady, and she just knocks them all out of the way, pulls it off of the flatbed truck, all the wires and everything that were holding it down, snap, and she lifts it up over. Top of one hand and over top of her shoulder like it's a tray with drinks on it.
I like this one guy. I could never exercise until I'm muscle bound and never do that. And then this guy says, this women's lib thing is getting more serious than I thought.
It's hilarious. So that's a really awesome opening scene. And I guess we should note this issue is actually inked by Mike Royer.
Yes.
Other than Vince Clita, probably the one that's known the most for inking Kirby at DC.
Yes. I like his inking better. It looks very more Kirby-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the faces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It looked like Coletta tried to like smooth out the faces more.
Yeah, and I think they actually... DC actually... at least at first, made him redo Superman's faces. They didn't like the way that Kirby drew Superman's face.
Right. That's probably why this guy... Because Superman's face looked more like Kurt Swan's face.
Yeah.
It was trying to adapt to a Kurt Swan type look.
I wanted him, but... Yeah, when I've seen Kirby's pencils... and then you see him inked by Mike Royer. It looks pretty similar, I would say.
Yeah.
But, yeah, then we get Wunderbar and his assistant are testing out a trap that they're going to use on Mr. Miracle. They're using a little action figure Mr. Miracle like as a test demo.
I love it because the other guy's like, look, I'm spinning around. He's going around. And then the shit just blows up in his face. And then he's like, the machine was perfect. It was capable of reaching incredible speeds. He says, don't you forget its purpose to kill Mr. Miracle. And then he's on the ground later on and he's like, I can't get up. I can't rise. The explosion has severely impaired me.
Yeah. Yeah, Wunderbar is so his assistant. It looks like his name is Heydrich,
and he ain't around. His assistant changes in the next few scenes.
But yeah, so he's got a short life, but yeah, it's
meanwhile Lundgren
wants to push it as far as he can.
Yeah, meanwhile Oberon is in a Civil War outfit and he's getting the Civil War cannon ready so he can explode Mr. Miracle out of the cannon.
This, I don't know if you saw, I tweeted this, the picture of Oberon. He's in his little like Civil War. I literally started laughing out loud. Like a lot of times when if something makes me laugh that I read, I'm laughing on the inside.
Yeah.
But this just, it's, as soon as I looked at the panel, I just burst out laughing. Look at me.
Yeah, that one. That was a funny one. Yeah.
How do you think I feel in this Civil War getup? Besides, if I get laughs from the audience, it could upstage your performance. A poor guy, man. Oberon, I feel for him. He's got a tough life.
It's like,
yeah.
Why are you making me dress like this? Come on, this is ridiculous.
Oh, man, the poor guy.
And Big Barda finds a pool of water, and she thinks it's ultimately heaven. And she gets attacked by Vundabar's troopers. It seems like each villain has their own unique set of underlings that they have certain soldier costumes. These ones look like they have bug heads.
Yeah, they do look, because Wunderbar is connected to Granny Goodness, right?
Yeah.
And they do kind of look similar. I think there might be different colors, or there might be, the helmets might be a little different, but they're kind of bug-eyed, which I think sort of is similar to Granny Goodness's soldiers in some ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, they drop down from this like flying box looking thing in the background, and they think that they're catching her off guard, but she's able to switch into her battle armor in a mere microsecond. Her skimpy costume suddenly fills out, and she's got her mega rod and starts battling.
It's weird because she has a bikini with like two holsters on the side, and somehow those holsters activated her armor, right?
They're called side clips, and I guess there's studs on them. She presses the stud, and in just a second, it makes her armor, her military uniform, appear, and the side clips change place to a holster for the mega rod.
This one panel cracks me up too, where Oberon's sitting there with a lighter, like ready to light the cannon. He just looks hilarious.
He's covering his eyes. It's really comical. I mean, like, it's so ridiculous that Scott bought a Civil War cannon and dresses up his little assistant in a Civil War outfit to fire the actual cannon.
And he almost kills Oberon with the recoil.
Yeah.
It almost runs over him.
I think it knocked him out because Scott comes up and like picks him up off the ground and he says, "What happened?" we both escaped. That's what.
Yeah, it's like, "We're growing, Oberon. You and I. This is going to be a sensational act."
Yeah, he said, "I knew you could move like lightning, but I never thought I could."
And they see that weird contraption or that had those soldiers come out of it, and they know that. They kind of guess that they've taken Big Barda away.
Yeah.
So he gets his arrow discs and goes after the Big Barda.
I like that that Oberon. Like, one thing I like about Oberon is he's pretty practical. You know, he doesn't really he doesn't take a lot of like silliness.
Yeah.
And Scott says, I mean, he's already commented on Scott Free's name, and Scott says, they must have sent somebody, like, perhaps an orphanage alumnus, like, capable Vermin Vundabar. And Oberon just says, his name is even goofier than yours.
Yeah, and I love the how he used, like, well, it's Oliver Twist, like the Artful Dodger, you know?
Yeah,
analogy, yeah. That was pretty cool. Like the orphanage,
right?
They had unusual names too.
Yeah, so it's purposeful. Yeah. But yeah, so that, I guess, so that box, it's called a Magna Lift, the thing that the soldiers came and took Bardo away in. And yeah, as you said, Scott gets on his aero discs to go after her and to go after Vermin Vanderbar.
And then as soon as he arrives, he gets imprisoned within this encasing and he enters the death machine or the car wash.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. I liked that he's not just a weird, you know, because he's from Apocalypse, Wunderbar is, and but he has, you know, he has that Russian name, and or German name, rather. And so I like that we get that explained in Scott's thoughts as he's on his way, that he really likes military precision and that Granny Goodness gave him the name, and you know, he patterned his life and his costuming and style and stuff on Earth Prussian.
It's kind of like a Nazi guy with a monocle.
Yeah, like you know, Prussian is like you know, it was the pre-Nazi Germany history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of like where they trace back their lineage and stuff. And so, you know, Scott comments on the fact that he actually, like, he's actually like ridiculously takes the whole thing seriously, and you know, thinks that he's actually, you know, has some connection to Germans and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's a nut job.
Pretty much, sort of it.
So he's like the Nazi one. He's kind of very similar to Dr. Bedlam, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets locked in this trap, enters the car wash, and they have all these contraptions. Like the first one is just beating the hell out of him. It's like clobbering the chamber. It's like bang, blong, clonk, clonk, just hitting him. And mm-hmm. then it's got these huge tubes to like snake-like clamps that surge power within it to like kind of fry him. And then he's got a new henchman because the other guy can't get up. Like he's on the floor still probably because he got, he was spinning the dummy Mr. Miracle and hurt himself, blew up. So this new henchman I like because he's kind of like that dog in the Laugh Olympics or whatever. You know, he's just a laughing dude. All he does is want to laugh. He's like, ha ha ha. It's like the sidekick that wants to laugh.
Like Muttley?
Muttley, yeah. He reminded me of Muttley because he's just sitting there laughing. Oh, you're beating the crap out of him. You're going to kill him.
Yeah. And actually, you know what? I want to say that reminded me, the fact that he's got a new assistant reminds me of Star Wars, you know, when Darth Vader chokes the one dude.
Yeah, a new admiral or something.
Yeah, and they make fun of that in Spaceballs, I think. But yeah, so they also set the encasing on fire and drop it into a vat of acid.
I love this scene because it reminds me of a cartoon, like a Bugs Bunny cartoon or something. Where the villains are laughing, you know, like there, and then Mr. Miracle's standing there with a smile right in back of them.
Yeah. his face is, the smile on his face is perfectly drawn.
Yeah, and those guys are really enjoying it. They're like, they're like laughing because they think they killed him. And they didn't kill him.
Yeah, and then, his assistant's like, if I can't laugh, can I at least clap? He's like, no, this is okay. It's okay. We can laugh now.
And then Mr. Miracle always feels like he has to explain how he got out of the trap. And early on in the trap, I guess he used his boot jets to blast the ground underneath it and escape through the bottom of the encasing.
Yeah, I did think it was kind of funny that Wunderbar accuses him of using the mother box.
Yeah.
And he's like, I wouldn't cheat like that. And then he just goes on to explain how he uses different... It's still technology. Like,
yeah, what's the difference?
I didn't really see the difference there, Scott, but
yeah.
But it's all good.
So he rescues Big Barda. In the next issue, we're supposed to get Funky Flashman.
I guess he felt like every single issue of Mr. Miracle had to introduce a new character.
Yeah.
which is pretty awesome. But and we have another backup, and this one I did like. I thought it was pretty cool because it's the first time we ever get to see Scott Free back when he was part of Granny Goodness's kit, her orphanage.
Dogs. One thing that I found interesting is he like went through a gang line like and they beat the crap out of him. Like they all yeah. their sticks and just pummeled him. Like his face got all jacked up.
Yeah, he isn't at this point, you know, he's not totally rebellious, but he's getting punished because he wasn't willing to kill. He was given living specimens, and it was a lesson in prisoner interrogation. It's a very pleasant orphanage.
He failed the test.
Yeah, so they escaped on him. So he's being punished for that, but he's not where, you know, he still is under her spell a bit because he's upset when she takes the recorder that she has that plays her voice to him. And then he's forced to, like you said, he's forced to go out and march. And then he has to walk down the line of all of his, like, fellow students who are more than happy to, like, beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, it's like if you had to a gang initiation to walk the line and they beat the crap out of you while you walk it. That's yep. what they did, except they all had pipes and stuff, and they, like, just pummeled him.
But at the very end, we get a glimpse of, you know, things for the how things became what they are in the future when Metron shows up in his cell, and Scott at first thinks that he's part of, you know, Darkseid's enemies, Darkseid's armies. So, yeah, that was pretty cool. I liked seeing Scott's past there and seeing him as a part of in the uniforms. They're all thought it was interesting how they're all bald, like all
yeah.
students are all shaved bald.
They all look the same.
Yeah, pretty much like
kind of like Clone Wars, like the stormtroopers.
Yeah. Yeah, how they're all clones and they're just kinda like made to look like each other by having all their heads shaved and stuff, so
that was it seems they're very meaty. I mean, all these issues have a lot. Like, it's no joke. Takes you good time to read them, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And I really like this issue a lot. I mean, not just comparison to the Jimmy Olsen issues, but just overall. I mean, this is a really awesome issue. A really strong issue as far as these Fourth World.
Yeah, I love the big Barda stuff where those guys are like, damn, she's sexy, and they just want to sit there and watch.
Yeah.
I need to get a commission with that big Barda outfit. I really
yeah.
do.
Yeah. That'd be pretty cool. Yeah, that'd be a good addition to your collection.
Yes.
Do you have her in a different...
Well, I was thinking of doing that if the... I should mention this Kickstarter, but... Because it does have a retro aspect to this Kickstarter. So I supported this Kickstarter by the Tim Seeley, Steve Seeley, and Michael Morikai. And they're doing this thing, this Kickstarter about mini comics. And mini comics was a big yeah. thing in toys. Like if you got a He-Man toy or whatever mm-hmm. toy you got at the time, you get a mini comic. And yeah. What they're doing is they're doing something very similar to, you know, kickstart this, is they're doing mini comics and you have different tiers. Like if you go to a certain tier, you could get an actual action figure with the mini comics. So it's very, you know, these are characters that they created and you can actually get these toys, which are limited that you can get. I chose to get a commission from Tim Seeley because I like his art.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to choose what character you want drawn.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, Tim Seeley's known for, like, Hack Slash and other stuff that he's done. And I was thinking of either getting a Big Barda or an Elastigirl from the Doom Patrol in the miniskirt.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, if this gets funded, there's still a way off. because they're asking for 19,000 as a goal, and they're, you know, they're roughly almost halfway there.
How much time is left?
24 days.
Oh, cool. It's a pretty good amount of time.
But it's really cool because they have like an ad of all the action figures that they created. And if you watch the video, some of the characters' names are hilarious.
Nice. Yeah, those are all good creators. That'd be cool. Hopefully that gets funded. That'd be pretty neat. But yeah, it definitely has a connection. I remember getting those. I mean, nowadays, every once in a while you get a comic. I don't think they're usually not mini comics, though. I think there's the line of Marvel where there's like two characters, and I think it's like a full issue, though.
Yeah,
full size issue.
Sometimes you'll get one with a DVD, like a DC Direct DVD or stuff with a mini comic in it. And I remember the last one I got had Superman and the Flash running on it. And they used to come with some video games like Atari Force and stuff, you know? They were big in the video games as Atari was publishing. So this looks like a fun project, and if you had any memories of it, you might want to go fund it.
Well, you can get you can get Mordecai or you can get him to sketch you. Even though he's not, he said the sketch will be terrible. He's not an artist, but hilarious, and he'll sketch you as your favorite character. Do you get him to draw you as Omek?
Yeah. This is really a cool project. Like, I like Kickstarters where I feel like I get like I would buy, if I was to go to a con, I'd pay exactly what I'd pay for something. You get the same value for whatever you're supporting. I really like when they do that for you.
Yeah, and this is, you know, one of the things that's nice. The kind of thing that you only see on Kickstarter, something that clearly this is something that these guys really want to do and they're having fun with it. It's not something that they're just doing for money or even just a combination of, you know, money and, you know, compromise of some sort. They really, it's a project of love.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely an appropriate Kickstarter for the Retrocast.
Yeah, my tier is already all gone. So some of the tiers where they only have like a couple options because they have like a limited toy or something, they're all gone. So you have to jump on it if you want certain tiers. Like the tier I got, I think it's only got three left. Oh no, mine is all gone. Never mind.
Was it three to begin with, maybe?
Yeah, well, mine was get all six books plus an original ink commission from Tim Seeley.
Right.
You name it. And nice. And that was a good tier. I'm glad I jumped on it because I got the last one. But yeah, there's some pretty cool things there. But do you want to jump into our middle topic, which is like our top favorite retro sitcoms?
Yeah, definitely.
This was a hard list for me, but I guess I just picked the ones that I watched and I still watch, I guess.
Yeah, I kind of made... So one thing I did realize going into and looking these up was that we really did watch a lot of sitcoms as a family growing up. That was kind of our main, you know, evening activity, way more than I do now. But I mean, I think at some point we got a VCR, but I mean, I can remember before we ever had a VCR, and even when we had a VCR, I mean, you know, options and entertainment weren't as just crazy abundant as they are nowadays. So,
when I first started, you had four networks: NBC, ABC, PBS, and NBC.
Yeah, and even when you started to get cable channels and stuff, it was a while before cable channels all had scripted programs and dramas and sitcoms and stuff. You didn't, you started getting cable channels and stuff. They were real specialized. It's like back when MTV actually played music videos all day, 24/7, So choices were more limited, but yeah, so we watched a lot. So I had to narrow it down. I had a ton that I watched. And then I had some like honorable mentions and, but I tried to narrow it down to top five, not just mostly based on how I felt about them at the time, not like how I feel about them now.
I did something very similar. My top five is a list of ones that are more towards when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But I put some honorable mentions as I became like a teenager and later on in life when I was an adult that still, I think, passed the 10-year mark, some of them. Maybe one of them doesn't, but I wanted to mention them anyway. But well, I thought we could alternate.
Yeah, sure.
I have no particular order, but I'll mention these because I watch these all the time. Like, I'd watch them every week, and if I missed it, I missed it. But because there was no recording device, but as a family, like, we'd sit down and watch these things.
Yeah.
But my favorites, this one, I don't know if it was a really funny one, but I guess you can place it as a sitcom, is Happy Days. I would always watch Happy Days with the Fonz and Ralph Mouth and Pachi and all those characters, the Cuttinghams. And I even watched it through when they said they jumped the shark, with the where you literally did jump the shark, but think I watched it to the end and even joined in on the Joni and Chachi and the world that came after it. But that's one of my picks.
And was that, so did you watch it when it was new?
Yeah, I watched it as it was coming out. It wasn't like a TV Land thing. It was like, we sit down in front of the TV and watch it.
I know I saw it in reruns when I was a kid, and I'm not really sure I understood until later that it wasn't made in the 50s.
Yeah.
Because it was like 70s, about the 50s or whatever.
Yeah. But
I don't know if I really got that at the time.
But it spawned off like Laverne and Shirley and I think Mork from Mork. I can't remember. Mork and Mindy. Which are two sitcoms that I also watched, but I never was a... We always watched Laverne and Shirley like as a family, but I never really bonded to that show. Do you know what I mean? It was like, mm-hmm. I watched it because it was on.
Yeah.
I didn't care for it. Lenny and Squeaky I liked a lot, but other than that, I didn't care for it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you might watch a show because it's on right after a favorite show or something.
Yeah.
I definitely had ones like that. But, well, I put as my number five Full House.
I did watch a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, this ran from 87 to 95, so I definitely was only watching it in the first early seasons, because 95 I would have been a sophomore in high school, so I definitely wasn't watching it then. But it ran for 8 years, or 8 seasons rather, so probably the first 3 or 4 years I watched it, and it's not one that I still care for, but it was huge phenomenon at the time when it first came on. When I watched it, it was a part of their TGIF Friday nights. So, when I was younger and stuff, so I didn't have other plans Friday nights. And I guess later on it moved to Tuesday nights, and I wasn't watching it anymore by that time. But this basically, as most people know, it was Bob Saget and John Stamos, and this is where the Olsen twins came from, and all that stuff. So I liked it a lot at the time.
I was trying to remember, and the Olsen twins are what I remember from it, and the Bob Saget.
Yeah.
It was three dudes living together, raising the girls, right? Was there a woman character in it?
Eventually, Jesse, like Uncle Jesse, his either wife or girlfriend, I can't remember if they moved out, but Lori Loughlin, or whatever her name is, the actress, she ended up on the show as like his wife or something like that. But it was like Bob Saget, Danny Tanner, I think his wife passed away or something, and you know, so he ended up having to raise the girls himself, so he pulled in his Uncle Jesse and his friend, who was played by Dave Coulier, to help out and stuff. So it's kind of like Three Men and a Baby. Another classic. So,
all right. So my next one is All in the Family. Nice. You could tell the generation gap here is a lot different. But
yeah.
This is another one that I watched, and in hindsight, it was a really raunchy show. Like he was like a racist on TV.
Yeah.
Because he didn't respect a lot of people. He treated them like shit. Archie Bunker and Edith. His wife was the opposite. So she was the sanity of the family. And then you had Meathead, which is the live-in husband that married the daughter. I can't remember the daughter's name.
Rob Reiner?
Rob Reiner, yep, who became a famous director. It was Meathead. And he was married to Archie Bunker's daughter, which I can't remember her name now. But she's known now for like her infomercials or whatever for helping Africa and stuff. But I can't think of her name. But man, he was like a really raunchy dude, but I remember always laughing. I don't know if it was because it was I didn't know better or what, but God, I have so many memories of honorable mentions. I just want to mention
Sally Struthers.
Yeah, Sally Struthers. So yeah, that was one of my, and all of these had like classic theme songs. Like you'd know them if you heard them. So, All in the Family. What do you got next?
My next one I have is The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Ah.
And again, this was one that I watched first couple seasons, and then, you know, it was on, it stretched on after. That's probably why these are like, you know, my 4 and 5, because I watched the first couple seasons. This one was on from 1990 to 1996, so I only watched the first couple seasons, but obviously this is Will Smith. And I don't know how I ended up, like, when, for a couple years in elementary school, I was real into rap music. I used to watch Rap City on BBC, or not BBC, BET, and I used to tape videos off of it. And so I did know Will Smith because he started out as a rapper, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. And this was kind of where what he used to transition to the Will Smith that we know today. It was kind of like based a little bit on before the show started, he actually had money troubles because of IRS issues and stuff like that. And NBC approached him about doing a show, and it ended up being really successful. It was produced by Quincy Jones and stuff. But yeah, most people my age can sing you the opening theme song.
You know, I don't think I've ever watched a single episode of that.
Oh, really?
Whereas I have watched some Full House.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like he wrote the theme song himself. At least like the lyrics and stuff like that, he rapped them. And you just heard it over and over again every time you watch an episode, so it got stuck in your head.
All these songs would get stuck in your head, I think.
Oh, yeah. A lot of them I remember.
Yeah. So my next one actually spawned out of... I think one of the themes you'll see is a lot of shows spawned off other shows in sitcoms in this era. But All in the Family spawned off the next show that was in my list, and that's The Jeffersons.
Oh, yeah.
Always watched The Jeffersons. They were introduced in All in the Family as cleaning. You know, they do dry cleaning and stuff. And they eventually hit successful and moved on up. And they had a crazy white guy. I think his name was Bentley. That would always come by and visit, but I enjoyed that show. And then it actually had a maid, and that maid got her own show, but I can't remember her name either. But The Jeffersons.
Yeah. So my next one, my number three. I think I probably did watch it straight through its run because it was only on for four seasons from 86 to 90, and that was Elf. Alien Life Form.
I actually have one of those toys.
Nice.
The doll that came for the show, the talking one where you'd push his belly and he'd praise.
Yeah, my mom's friend's son, I remember he had that one. But, this is about a family, the Tanners, and mom, dad, and daughter and son, and their cat, which is significant because they take in a alien whose real name is Gordon Shumway. And he's like a little, like, toddler height, orange, furry. It's like, if you're listening, you've probably seen him. But he's a pretty, like, crazy-looking dude. He's got a snout, and he would burp a lot. And, you know, people from his race, they eat cats. So that was one of the things that was kind of done for humor, is that he really wanted to eat their cat, but, like, they wouldn't let him, because obviously we keep cats as pets on Earth. But it was a pretty big phenomenon in the late 80s, and we loved it. My family, Elf was pretty popular. I think there was even an Elf comic, to bring it into our main Marvel Comics, had an Elf comic book.
I remember that from the Star line or something.
Yeah, I even had a few issues. They actually said it looks like it ran pretty much the whole time the show was on. There was actually 50 issues, plus specials. Oh, yeah, he was pretty damn popular.
All right. My next one is probably, as we narrow down to the next two, is like my all-time favorite, but Sanford and Son. I absolutely love this show. I own these on DVD, nice. So I could still watch it, but Red Fox, and they own a junkyard, and they're not very rich. It's usually just them two and a couple of side characters. The one side character I remember is Aunt Esther. She would always come because Sanford lost his wife. Well, that was her sister, I believe, and she was real religious, and they actually hated each other, so it made for great comedy. But very, very big fan of this show, and also a classic theme song for this one. Like, if you heard it, you would know instantly what it is, even if you weren't in that generation.
Yeah.
Desmond Wilson played Lamont. He was his son. He always tried to leave the business and try to explore other things, because I guess he didn't think there was a lot of money in junk. But they had Grady. He had his own sitcom. He was in Bubba. Those were friends of Fred G. Sanford. And Rolo was Lamont's friend. So, and then they had two white cops. Well, one black cop, one white cop. And the white cop was like the comic relief. And eventually he moved out and they had a white guy come in and the show just became Sanford, but I still watched it, that show too. So I, nice. I like watched this one until it totally died.
Yeah, it's a lot of times like shows will get canceled earlier, or you'll have, you know, the last few seasons won't be as good. It's like they're trying to, you know, do weird things to keep the ratings up, or they'll bring in a new kid or something. Usually it was one of the typical strategies to try to keep ratings up, you know, bring in a cute kid and stuff. But it's rare the show that actually stays good all the way to the end, you know?
Yeah. Well, it didn't stay good all the way to the end. It just was... Towards the end, I started to watch it by habit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I loved it so much. But it really was in its prime when it was Lamont and him. You know, mm-hmm. That's when it was really funny. They still kept some of the characters around when Lamont left. But it was a good show. If you hadn't tried it, you should check it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen it. Most of the ones that you mentioned, I've seen an episode here or there, you know, just on, like you said, TV Land or something like
that. That's when TV Land really was TV Land. Now it's morphed into something else, just like MTV and everything else.
Well, and I think a lot of times now it's reruns of stuff from when I was a kid, which still seems weird to me. I'm like, I'm not that old.
Well, I would like it. Well, for you, that's probably good, because then you could see the stuff that you're talking about. But
yeah.
But they're doing like original programming now too, like you know, like right to like a sitcom that is being filmed right now. There's like they have like a couple of, you know, shows like that.
And they'll do like reality shows based around old TV stars too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my last two probably won't come as too much of a surprise, especially my number two, which is Who's the Boss. This podcast has documented well my attraction to Alyssa Milano as a kid. I think that was pretty much the reason that I watched the show. I mean, it was a good show, though. It was. I don't think I even watched this one all the way to the end, though, because it was on for 8 years, and it ran from 84 to 92. I think the last few years, my crush on her had probably transferred over. I was in high school, I was in middle school, and I think my crush on her was turning into a crush on Cindy Crawford at that point, or whoever I could see in like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue that I stole. But but yeah, it was a good show. I mean, Tony Maselli, played by Tony Danza. He used to be a baseball player who had to retire early, and of all things, he becomes a live-in housekeeper for a divorced woman. And Alyssa Milano played his daughter, who comes with him, and the divorcee, played by Judith Light, she has a son, and her mother, played by Katherine Helmond, was a big source of... they like to write a lot of... she was also on Soap, and she's been on some other shows since then, but they used to write her as like the dirty old lady.
Was Tony Danza in Soap too, or no? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think so.
I know he was in Taxi.
I think that's what I was thinking of, Taxi. Taxi was his first big show, and that's...
And that one had Danny DeVito and God, the Christopher Lloyd.
Christopher Lloyd and, you know, Andy Kaufman earlier on. Or no, like maybe the whole time.
I can't remember what Andy Kaufman did to kill his career. Do you remember?
Well, I mean, he was...
He did something racist or something, right?
His style of comedy was very...
raunchy?
Confrontational, kind of. Like, experimental. He had a character, Tony Clifton, who was like a... he was like a lounge singer character that like did audience work where he like made fun of the audience and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he also like he got into professional wrestling like as like a joke, like he would wrestle women and he called it the intergender wrestling or something like that. But it was all like a joke and made up, but like people didn't really get that, like he was, so a lot of it was like pretending to be, stuff, but he was sick and, you know, he was only 30 something when he died.
Oh, wow. I remember he made a weird movie called Heartbeat Beeps with, can't even remember her name, but where there were like robots. Yeah. It was like a C-3PO and R2-D2, except there's a romance.
Oh, I never heard of that. That's pretty cool. So that was my number two.
All right, my last top five. I mean, I have a couple I still want to mention. But Three's Company. I love Three's Company.
It was mentioned that one.
Yeah, John Ritter played Jack Tripper, Joyce DeWitt, Janet Wood, and Suzanne Summers played Chrissy Snow. And I watched this through all the generations of even when he owned his own restaurant. And Larry was the neighbor that would always come in. He always was trying to get dates with Jack. It was an interesting story because Jack had to pretend he was gay in order for the Ropers this was a big...
Oh, yeah.
A big joke every episode. He had to pretend he was gay for the Ropers to allow him to live with the two women because he wasn't married. So he would always be gay. The Ropers would walk in. Mr. Roper would always make gay jokes. And the gayness lasted all the way through into Don Knotts. Don Knotts became the super of the apartment building.
Oh, right.
And a huge Don Knotts fan that I am. And Larry, later on, Suzanne Summers left the show and Terry joined her. She was played by Priscilla Barnes. And there was even another woman that came in that became really attracted. I think she owned it for a while. She was really attracted to Jack and always trying to hit on him. But they would always go to the Regal Beagle. That was like the bar to hang out. But this spawned off the Ropers. So, you know, that show lasted, I think, one or two seasons. And I think it spawned off another show, too. I really wish I had done my research to know what they all spawned off, but I watched all of that.
Yeah, anytime a show was popular, I mean, it doesn't happen as much now, but back in the 70s and 80s, sitcoms were so popular, you know, and that was the day of the sitcoms, really, back then. And it was a very common thing. Anytime a show was popular... you know, it would spin off new shows. Most of the time, not as popular as the old ones. But my number one actually is an example of that as well. And I mean, this one is probably by far my number one by far. This show, which is the Cosby Show.
I kind of knew that was
you know, I watched this all the way up till the end. It ran from 84 to 92. So basically the same as Who's the Boss. But whereas, you know, we weren't really watching Who's the Boss towards the end. We were still watching The Cosby Show. And actually even the last couple years, Fox put The Simpsons up against The Cosby Show, and I didn't really watch The Simpsons till after The Cosby Show was on, or maybe we taped it because they were right up against each other. But like I said, The Cosby Show spun off a few different shows. The most notable one was probably A Different World.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah, that was on right after it, and it was kind of, the connection was that I was, you know, it was kind of based in a college, and it was about, I think, one of the Cosby children.
It was, what's her name, Bonet, wasn't it?
Might have been Denise, yeah.
I remember the controversy of her being in a movie called Angel Heart, which was about the devil, where she appeared nude, and the fact that she was on The Cosby Show.
Yeah, I mean, The Cosby Show was pretty
family-oriented.
It's very family-oriented. It's, you know, and it's interesting, like, as a, one of the things as an adult that I appreciate about it is that, like, I grew up pretty much in a white neighborhood, and, like, I grew up going to schools and, like, high school where there was probably, I think, maybe, like, two or three black families. But I grew up not really, like, thinking that, you know, because The Cosby Show presented a black family, I grew up not really thinking of, like, you know, that there were, like, black people were different or something, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I mean, that was, as an adult and in college stuff, I became educated to different, like, nuances in, like, African-American community and stuff, and not everyone has the perspective that Bill Cosby has, and the approach that he, that was one of the things with The Cosby Show, is to, like, you know, his character is a physician, his wife is a lawyer.
Well-to-do family.
Well-to-do family. You know, his parents are also educated. You know, and a lot of his comedy also was sharing, like, family experiences and stuff. And so, you know, I think that it was to the show's credit in terms of his goals that he had for the show was, like, I didn't grow up thinking, like, not that I heard this from my parents or anything like that. I mean, my parents are, didn't, like, encourage the opposite by any means and stuff, but, like, I wasn't really, exposed to, like, a lot of cultural just in my day-to-day life in school and stuff like that, so, but obviously at the time growing up, I mean, I just thought it was a really funny show, a really good show, and it had a really good balance between, like, humor and, like I said, like a sort of a message and stuff. You know, and Cosby's always been a favorite of mine as a result. And this one, I think, out of all of them, is the one that still, I can still watch The Cosby Show and enjoy it. I think it really stands up.
Yeah. That's one thing I could say about all the ones I picked is, to me, they still stand up except for Happy Days. Like, as much as I watched it, I can't watch it now.
I think Cosby Show's actually the only one I would watch now.
Yeah.
I mean, I could watch some of them out of, like, nostalgia just to see what it was like, but this is the one that I probably, and another thing that was kind of cool was, like, Rudy Huxtable, the actress is Keisha Knight Pulliam. She is actually literally the same age as me, so, you know, as she got older on the show, later they did do the thing where they introduced, and when she got older, they introduced a new, you know, little girl, but she got older on the show. I got, you know, she was basically always, because she's literally, I mean, I didn't realize this until I was, like, looking things up and stuff, but she's actually born literally, like, 2 days after me. Same year, 2 days after me, so it's kind of fun. That's kind of funny, but yeah, so kind of point of view character, you know.
Right.
But
do you want to go over some honorable mentions?
Yeah, I can just
Mine are really not honorable mentions. They really should be in my list, but they're they just didn't make the cut because I try to focus on more when I was younger. But WKRP in Cincinnati, I absolutely love this show. This one featured a radio show owned by a guy that didn't know what he was doing. And one of the main characters was Dr. Johnny Fever, played by Howard Hessman, who was also in another popular TV comedy. Lonnie Anderson was the secretary. Les Nessman was the news reporter. Frank Bonner was the guy who'd like sell ads and stuff like that. And Andy Travis was like the program director. But oh, and I can't forget Venus Flytrap. He was another DJ. So they had Venus Flytrap and Dr. Fever were the two DJs. But and Bailey Quarters was the other female in the show. But absolutely love this show. And it's another show I have on DVD. And I didn't realize that a lot of these shows you could, if you had Amazon Plus, it looks like you could watch them. Nice. Which I might consider getting now that I'm seeing all the damn shows that they have. Did you have any honorable mentions you want to shoot out? We'll just alternate real quick.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of jotted a bunch down. You know, one definitely that was, I think, like, I would appreciate, like, if I did ones that, if I watched them today, what I would like, I think I could still appreciate this was Wonder Years. And that was a really good show, and I think I would still, that's kind of interesting.
That one I actually discovered late and said, I got to watch this, but it's hard. At the time, I think I could watch it now, but when I wanted to watch it, there was like no means because they didn't have a DVD set.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of...
I think there were issues when the first thing, because of all the music they had in this damn thing.
Yeah, that does end up coming up with the older shows that they didn't, like, you know, think of it as something that would be on DVD or people would want to watch shows on DVD like that. But, yeah, so that was that was a really good show.
That was a good show. I mean, I can only speak from when they were a lot older because I caught it, like, at the tail end, do you know?
No, I think that's one that stands up, though.
Yeah, it's good. Let's see, what else do I got? I got Charles in Charge. I love this show. It's with Scott Baio and Willie Ames, I think is his name. It's about a guy that is actually a guy babysitter for a sort of family that has two daughters and one boy. And they pretty much have to take care of the kid the whole time because I guess their parents are always working. But they always get into mischief and stuff, but I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think that one, I saw some of that.
Another one that still holds up, because I was watching it on instant streaming before they took it off.
Nice.
Yeah.
I think, wasn't that like, Charles in
charge of our days and our
nights. speaking of theme songs, like for some reason, Golden Girls, we used to watch that one. Like kids watching a show about old women making dirty jokes. It just doesn't seem right. I mean, I've seen it as an adult, and it's like, damn, like most of these jokes are like sex jokes. But that one was like, thank you for being a friend. And I could still see it. Your heart is true. You're pale and a confidant.
I saw that like the first season, and the one thing I liked was the older woman. I don't know what her name was. She was the oldest. She was like someone's mother.
Oh, yeah. She was the highlight of the show.
Yeah.
Sophia,
yeah.
She always just talk about how she's from Sicily.
Yeah.
And the funny thing that people always mention is that she was the youngest of all the actresses.
Oh, really?
She was actually the youngest, yeah.
But she played the oldest.
Right, yeah.
That's interesting. I don't know what that says about the actress, that she looked the oldest, but she was the youngest.
Well, she wore a wig and, like, makeup and stuff. Estelle Getty. Yeah.
Yeah.
She,
wonder if she's related to Balthazar.
I don't know. But, yeah, she was, that was the thing that people always used to mention because it was kind of funny because she looked so much older with the makeup and everything. And the, and that had a spinoff, actually, Empty Nest. Was a spinoff of the Golden Girls, but that was another one we used to watch.
All right, the latest ones. I'm kind of surprised that didn't make your list because they're more later. But Cheers.
Oh, I have that as an honorable mention.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't put it in my top five because I only watched it towards the end, kind of, because it was on. When in its early years, it was on a little too late for me.
Yeah, but Cheers always made me laugh, and I did catch that later because this was later in life,
mm-hmm.
And Night Court.
Yeah,
those are
back
two that
back.
I absolutely loved, and they're shows that I could watch today and still enjoy.
Yeah, I think for a long time, Cheers was on at 9 and Night Court 9:30, and I used to sometimes see the beginning of Cheers earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like later on, we'd stay up till 10. But, you know, when I was little, like we only stay up till 9
yeah.
for a while. So,
well, you're on the East Coast. You got crazy time. I don't even know how you guys even stay to watch anything. You can't even watch a football game.
Yeah, you're like, what are you talking about? 9 o'clock.
Yeah, what's going on? Why is the game ending at 11 or 12? Come on.
Yeah.
Oh,
man.
I don't know how you go to work the next day.
Well, that's the thing that comes up. It's like during like the World Series and stuff like that, they try to time it so that the whole, you know, nation, but like on the East Coast, that means it's the latest. I mean, I can't even. Yeah, depending on the team, sometimes I just can't even stay up because it's like by the time they go through all like the rigmarole and the introduction stuff, the game doesn't even start till like 8:45.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but there's.
I mean, I have some like I'll just say the names of them. I won't say really much about them, but Roseanne was a really big one.
Oh, that one I liked.
Yeah, Growing Pains, Family Matters. Those are probably honorable mentions. Then just some other shows that I know, like some of them I kind of forgot about till I was looking up for this, that Home Improvement, Blossom, Webster, Mr. Belvedere, Perfect Strangers, Different Strokes, Head of the Class.
That's where, Dr. Johnny Fever was in. That's the other
thing. Yeah. Yeah. Head of the Class.
Howard Hessman.
Yeah, he went on to Head of the Class, and he played a school teacher with, like, a really crazy class.
Gifted class, character. Wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It was a good show. Yeah, it was cool.
A very weird cast of characters, obscure characters that were gifted.
Yeah, yeah, they were, like kind of troubled kids because they were too smart for their... for being a teenager.
Right.
But, so, yeah, I watched a lot of sitcoms when I was a kid, apparently.
Just two that I absolutely love that I want to mention is Seinfeld. I still can watch this show over and over and over again and make references to it all the time.
That stands up, yeah. I watched on DVD not that long ago. I watched, like, the first couple seasons.
Yeah.
Again,
me and my wife will watch it on TBS even when it's on, like they still show it. And even though mm-hmm. I own them on DVD, I'll still watch them on TBS. The other one I want to mention that's an HBO one that I absolutely love is Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is very much in the vein of Seinfeld humor, just in a different vein. It's by the creator of Seinfeld, Larry David.
Mm-hmm.
There's
Kara's dad's a big Seinfeld fan.
Oh, I freaking love it.
He's always like, that's his point of reference for a lot of stuff, you know.
Yeah, like, Festivus instead of Christmas, let's do Festivus.
He's like, that's. He's always saying that's like that one Seinfeld episode. Remember where such happened?
Yeah,
I've seen every episode.
We actually love it. So you want to jump into some comics, or do you need to take a break, or?
I think I'm good. We can all take right. a break if you need to, though.
No, I'm all right.
Okay.
I had some interesting reads, and I guess the ones I'll cover is I'll do them kind of rapid. I won't like go into a lot of depth, but I have two DCs, one Marvel, and one independent.
Oh, okay.
So I was going to cover all the various today, but I only everything that I read was a hardcover or a trade paperback, but the most unique one that I read and I never read before, and I've always wanted to and I never did because I never bought a lot of Treasury editions or the collector's editions that were huge magazine size. They're mm-hmm. actually bigger than that. I own a few. I have like Superman versus Muhammad Ali. I have Superman versus the Flash, but I don't have many others. I have a couple Marvel ones and a Superman, the movie, an adaptation that came out like that. But the one I've always wanted to read that was never able to was Superman versus Shazam. The other one I want to read too is the crossover ones, Batman versus the Hulk and Superman versus Spider-Man. And I've never read those either. These were really hard to obtain at the drugstore that I went to as a kid. Like, you'd have to order them. And I did send away for a few of them, and that's why I have them. But they're roughly $1.50 to $2 giant size magazines. And this was Superman versus Shazam. It was by, let me see who wrote it. I'm going to have to dig into who wrote it because it was by Jerry Conway and Rich Buckler. And I never remember talking about Rich Buckler, but good Lord, this guy can draw. I mean, he's like a George Perez before George Perez was big, I guess. I mean, like, it's very much in his style or Phil Jimenez style. Like, the mm-hmm. art is just beautiful. But it opens up in a multiverse world. Like, he's from Earth S and Superman's from Earth 1. And there's this villain from Mars that is a sorcerer, and he's an evil dude that's causing them to fight each other. His name is Karmang the Evil. So if you ever hear his name, I don't know if this is his first appearance or not. But he pretty much destroyed his own people and wants revenge to try to bring them back. So he killed a lot of the Martians because of his science. He was like a guy that used science to advance his culture, and his science eventually ended up destroying all of Mars. He wants to return. So he recruits Black Adam and another Superman knockoff who has some weird name I've never even heard of. but he looks exactly like Superman, and he's made of sand.
So that they kind of wanted to have, like, the way that Black Adam's the counterpart. They wanted to have Superman have his own double.
And the way he did it is they both put devices on each of their appropriate Earths. Black Adam went to our Earth, whereas that knockoff Superman flew to Earth S, and they had planted these devices that would sink the Earth so they would collide into each other because they were multi-Earths and destroy each other. And eventually... who saves the day is really Miss Marvel and Supergirl, because they realize what's going on while Superman and Shazam are having a punch out fight. The story is pretty average. Like, it's fun to read because of what it is historically, mm-hmm. but that Superman knockoff is called Quarmer. It's a weird name. His first appearance was in Superman 233. Which I should have, but I don't remember him. But while Miss Marvel and Supergirl realize what's going on, and they actually go to Mars and attack the villain, while Superman and Captain Marvel eventually take out the devices that are going to merge the worlds. And it's kind of funny is Mary Marvel... Mary Marvel is attracted like wickedly to Superman, so she like throws her arms at him at the end, And then when Supergirl does the same thing to Captain Marvel, she's real possessive because that's her twin brother. So it's like, hey, what are you doing, you slut? So I find that really interesting. But this is a trade paperback that came out recently because it's got the new DC 52 logo on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be covering some of the other books in these. Half of the book is the 72-page Giant Side book that I talked about, and the rest are DC Comics Presents with their team-ups. And I actually love the Big Red Cheese, so I definitely want to read these.
Big Red Cheese.
Yeah.
All right, well, this is a good actual counterpart to that, because I read about a character that's kind of based on the Big Red Cheese. I read Prime number 1 and 2. I read some more Ultraverse.
Oh, nice.
After last time, I was kind of curious.
Did you see how the costume changed dramatically?
Yeah, so I had talked about, and you had mentioned that he looked different at first, and you're right. Like, by the time you get to Ultra Force, he's a real hairy dude, and he's like both chest hair and long hair on his head. And starting out, he's a lot more like classical, like clean cut looking, costumes different, like you said. No chest hair to be seen. And just like kind of a different look. But these were, speaking of Ultraforce, these were also written by Gerard Jones and with Len Straczewski. And they're drawn by Norm Breyfogle.
One of my favorite all-time artists. I like his style, especially when he was drawing Batman.
Yeah, and that's, I don't know if you remember, but I feel like these look kind of different.
It looks more cartoony.
Yeah, I
hate that to say that term, because these are comics. Everything looks like cartoons, but looks more like a animated type like style, maybe.
I was kind of surprised because I like his Batman work also, and so I normally like stuff that I've seen, but I didn't hate this, but it wasn't as much to my liking, although I guess it does kind of have an interesting effect in terms of the subject matter, because it is kind of a play on Shazam, but it's maybe like a more realistic, he doesn't really, so he's a 13-year-old for real. You know, and he doesn't really understand his own strength, so he accidentally like breaks a guy's arm, like literally like twists it, and so that the elbow snaps and the bone protrudes out of the skin. You know, and he's pretty dumb. Like, it's if a 13-year-old all of a sudden got superpowers and looked like an adult muscular male, unless they were a pretty bright 13-year-old, like, this is maybe a little bit closer to what would happen, or at least a little different take. I mean, the thing with this Shazam, they always kind of do, they take a different approach to it. There's still a bit of a discrepancy, even like modern interpretations on Young Justice and stuff, where he acts a little strange, like he acts not exactly how you'd think an adult would act, or he seems more childlike.
But he has the wisdom of Solomon.
Yeah, so that helps.
But that helps, but I always found it odd when I read the character.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times he acts like a child, but then I'm like, but you have the wisdom of Solomon. I don't get it. Maybe it's more of an innocent wisdom of Solomon, maybe.
Right. Yeah.
That he's a kid, but if he thinks he can tap into it, yeah.
But Prime, you know, he doesn't have the wisdom of Solomon. he also transforms differently. He's being fired on by tanks and stuff like that towards the end of the first issue, and his body starts to deteriorate. It's really actually pretty gross. Like, instead of some sort of magical transformation, he literally, the body adult body literally starts to deteriorate and melt. So there's these like really gross panels.
It's like boogers.
Yeah, where
or slime.
He's literally like fighting his way out of this melting body. He has to kind of punch his way. You know, this 13-year-old boy has to kind of like punch his way out and literally kind of like shed the skin. And the last panel of the first issue is him crawling away naked from this just nasty pile of old flesh. And there's all this like liquid all over the place, and he's throwing up. So disgusting.
It's not as glamorous as seeing Shazam. No,
it's over the top disgusting. And the next issue opens with him wandering down a neighborhood street, naked, covered in this like green goo, and he shows up at his he shows up at the front door of his house, and his mom answers the door, and he's passed out like naked, covered in goo, on their front porch. So they're like, he doesn't remember what he says. I don't remember what happened to him. So it's just like, if you know your son, like, I mean, you'd think the worst, you know, it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
So they obviously take him to the hospital, and again, they kind of subvert classical stories where in the second story, in the second issue, there's an attack on his high school, and we see him actually turn into Prime this time, where kind of the flesh and everything like that seems to almost protrude from his chest and wrap itself around him. But this is more maybe a play on Superman Lois Lane kind of thing, where the girl that he has a crush on at school, she ignores him earlier in the issue, and he picks her up as Prime to kind of save her, quote unquote. But instead of being she's briefly kind of, she's freaked out at first by being up in the air with him, and then she's briefly enjoys it just in time for Prime to be attacked. And as soon as the monster punches him, he drops her. So he manages to stop her from falling to her death, but she's had enough of it at that point, so she's not impressed. There's also the matter of the fact that she's a teenage girl and he appears as a man. So later she's talking to her friend. She says, "Listen, this is going to sound so totally made up, but I think he likes me." Her friend says, "You mean likes you?" "I mean likes me."
He's trying to hit like the awkward situation. This guy's an adult.
Yeah, so her friend's like, "But isn't he like 25 years old or something?" She says, "I guess." "Isn't that kind of weird?" "Yeah, it's very weird." So, I mean, and I don't even know if I would have thought of it, but yeah, like, it would seem really strange to them. So they deal, like, they sort of play with that idea. And then, you know, not to be outdone by the bio-horror of the first issue, it ends with Prime fighting this big purple one-eyed creature that when he punches it, his punch actually kind of goes into the creature, and we get more green goo, and it basically ends up trapping him inside of it. So he's kind of in like totally trapped inside of this big green or big blue purple. I'll get it right. Big purple creature with all this green goo again. So it's almost like a
theme of goo.
Yeah,
slime.
Like early Cronenberg movies, like all this like kind of gross bio horror stuff. So they're pretty cool stories. Like I said, I didn't care for the art as much as I do other Brave Fogel stuff that I've seen, earlier stuff that's more realistic style, but I guess it, the more, like you said, more cartoonish.
Well, the more you look at it, it does look Brave Fogel, because go look at the Batman. It's very, like, I could see it putting somebody into shock the way they draw, because it's very straight line artwork.
Yeah.
I follow him on Facebook. If you go look at some of his art, and you go look at compare it to the Prime, I think you'll see it, especially in the faces anyway.
Also, too, I think what's a little different is I'm used to seeing the older Batman artwork, and it's a different, you know, it's always talked about how Marvel is interested in their coloring process, and these issues, I mean, for being, you know, from the early 90s, look like modern comics as far as the color reproduction and stuff. I mean, they're very, very bright color, glossy pages and stuff, so they were kind of innovative at the time. But it's, like I said, it does create, like, more cartoony style does create an interesting contrast, you know.
Yeah.
It does kind of serve the purpose of the story to create a contrast between the kind of stories you're used to seeing from, like, a Shazam story or a Superman story, and it makes the ways that they deviate from that and play on those themes a little even more, like, effective, I think. So it's suitable for the subject matter, I would say.
Yeah.
And this was what I was going to say.
Well, I think that's what makes the art look different, too, is the fact that you're going from a dark book to something that's really, really, like you just said, super colorful.
Yeah, bright and...
bright and... yeah, it's like you're not in the shadows. It's not dark. It's daytime.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, but... and this was one of the Ultraverse... So I talked last time about Ultra Force and how I was kind of jumping in late in the game. This was, so I thought I'd kind of go back. This was one of the launch titles.
Yeah, that was the first one out the gate. Either that one or Hardcore, I can't remember.
Hard Case.
Hard Case, yeah. Those were Prime. Mantra was the other one. I think Prime was the first one to hit the shelf, I think.
Might have been. It looks like I was looking into it a little bit. Prime, Hardcase, and The Strangers all came out the first month.
Yeah.
And then the next month, they added Mantra and Freaks.
Yeah.
So and
Freaks was the least successful of the bunch.
Was it?
It didn't last long.
Yeah.
All right, my other DC book was Creature Commandos, number 105. It's actually Weird War Tales 105, featuring Creature Commandos. I wish that Creature Commandos had 105 issues.
That'd be awesome.
But Creature Commandos consisted of the ones that we've been seeing in the pre-52 was that vampire Velcro, or whatever his name is, Velcro, and the werewolf Griffin. And the Patchwork Man, which was the Frankenstein guy. And this was written by J.M. DeMatteis. Artist was Frank Carrillo. And the thing I really like about Weird War Tales is it's like a Tales from the Crypt involving war. But, man, I'm surprised this is like Comics Code approved, because it's just really violent. But... this one takes place in the United States during Nazi times, and inside of Washington, or New York, sorry, there's a village called Freedom in New York, and its population is only 67. And the one sergeant that has the commandos, that's always with the commandos, says his name is Matthew Shrive. Or Shreve, he actually takes them there on a mission because he finds out these are Nazi sympathizers. Thank you. I couldn't get that word out. I knew what I wanted to say, but
yeah,
they're Nazi sympathizers, and they're actually like worshiping Adolf Hitler, and they have to take out this town. And what they do is they demoralize them and make them freak out because they're monsters, and then they pretty much all leave the town. But it was a very interesting story. And the other one that's really interesting is written by Rob Kaniger, who did a lot of Sergeant Rock, and Ruben Yandok, who did a story called Stolen Skin. And this is a creepy story because it has concentration camp in it. And this is like towards the end of the war where the Germans are losing. And it mentions like, this one guy wants to, he's like, what am I going to do? Because we're going to get tortured. Like, we've been torturing people in the gas chambers and skinning people alive because they know what we did. you know, they'd pull out gold teeth and all that stuff and melt it. And he mentions, how can I escape if I have lampshades made of human skin? And he's got like a lampshade made out of the Jews from the concentration camp. And then he used Jewish women hair used for mattresses, stuffed the mattresses and their teeth to melt the gold. And he's talking about dead children. You know, it's pretty violent.
Yeah.
But what this guy ends up doing, because he finds there was two officers and the other officer tries to escape and he's killed immediately. And he's like, well, what am I going to do to survive? How can I hide from, you know, being hunted down? So he makes himself a Jew. He actually transports his body into a Jewish body and has the number and everything, you know, so they think he's a Jew from the camps. And he actually goes to hunt down Jews afterward. I mean, hunt down Germans afterwards. So he's like a weird character. But then he ends up in another area in Brazil. And they find out that he was... he's like, Hail Hitler. Hitler didn't die in this book. Hitler is hiding out in Brazil. So he sees Hitler and he's like, Hail Hitler. And he's like, what is this? He sees the number. Hitler actually ends up putting him in his own gas chamber. So it's like one of those, you know, like Tales from the Crypt story, because he puts him in the gas chamber, skins him alive, and then has him as a lampshade with his number on it. You know, Hitler does. So that was pretty creepy. And then it's got another horror story about two twin sisters that are separated at war. And then just a two-page story about a future, what war is in the future, where robots fight for us at like chess. That's how people win. But it was this was an awesome comic. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I have a few more Creature Commandos that I want to read because I want to finish this run. This is good.
Nice.
Weird War.
Yeah, I really like the Creature Commando concept.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. Well, I thought I'd mention a while back, you know, I did an online order of like some old DC back issues and stuff, and they threw a lot of times, like, you know, when I order stuff online, sometimes they'll throw in like a free issue or something, and it'll be something I don't want anyways. But I thought that this was actually kind of cool. They threw in a DC sampler from 1983. I don't know if you remember this, but this is actually a pretty cool sampler because it goes through all the most of the comics they were publishing at the time and have like double page spreads for them. So there's the first one is All-Star Squadron, and it was at the time promoting the issue 26. So you have this double page spread of the All-Star Squadron, and it's featuring the dynamic DC debut of the Infinity Inc. So they're fighting like Psycho Pirate, and it's this huge battle scene, and in the middle is like this contraption with Firebird, Metallo, and Superman strapped to it. We have all kinds of characters. I mean, the Flash, Golden Guardian, Liberty Bell, Phantom Lady, Alan Scott, just a whole bunch of different, like Jesse Quick. Like, it's just a really cool picture.
Yeah, those samplers were cool because they were like a whole comic.
Yeah. So you get like one for the Superman books, and DC Comics presents Superboy, Superman Action Comics. And this was when Kerry Bates and Kurt Swan were doing Superman, and Marv Wolfman and Gil Kane were doing Action Comics. And it says, have you looked at Superman lately? Check out what you've been missing. Superman and Lois Lane, Split, Clark Kent and Lana Lang, Together, Perry White, In Trouble, Jimmy Olsen, Out of Trouble, Steve Lombard, Fired, Justin Moore, Hired, Luther and Brainiac, Updated. So that was kind of like their shot by shot. Then you got a big double page for Orion, Lord of Atlantis.
Oh, that's, yeah.
This one's actually pretty text-heavy. They have, like, all these captions that explain through who all the different characters are.
I wonder if they had Arik. Did they have that in there?
Let me see. Oh, it might. Yeah, I think he's later on. There's one for Omega Man that's just...
That's where Lobo was introduced, the Omega Man.
So, in contrast, there's not much text at all on that one. Wonder Woman, this is when they had the... This is around Wonder Woman 308, and it's when they had the Huntress backups.
Oh, yeah, that's there I'm reading right now.
It's pretty cool.
Those are good. For me personally, I'm a Wonder Woman fan. Those are good. It's a good era.
Yeah, they show this double page was drawn by Don Heck, and they actually have Black Canary and Elongated Man in the background.
Mm-hmm.
It shows Huntress like in a little. So then.
That was an era where the Huntress feature was almost more popular than the Wonder Woman one. Like for
was it?
Yeah, people were writing in more for that book than, and Paul Levitz, who's writing the Huntress right now, is doing it.
Nice.
Yeah.
So the Batman one, it's kind of like the Superman one where they do it for all the books that. So you have Batman, which was Doug Munch and. Don Newton at the time, and Detective Comics, which was also Munch with Gene Colan. And you also have Batman and the Outsiders, so that was Mike Barr and Jim Aparo. Mm-hmm. And so it shows the Outsiders team, which was the original, like Halo, Metamorpho, Katana, Black Lightning, and Geo-Force, are kind of coming across a rooftop with Batman. Amethyst, speaking of Amethyst, Princess of Gem World, there's a big old double page ad for that. You also have New Teen Titans, of course, being 83. This was, this is a really cool, obviously this is George Perez, it's a pretty cool double page. This is actually the centerfold, and along the top you have 8 rectangles, one for each character, because Tara was on the team. I'm making it 8, and then the bottom is the 8 of them, like all flying towards you, with like the tower in the background. But just for what's going on, I won't mention all of them, but each one has a question about the character and what was going on at the time, and like, what is the secret of Donna Troy's past, and when will Tara Markov betray the Teen Titans, and Deathstroke is in, like, the background behind her. We got G.I. Combat and Sergeant Rock together. We got World's Finest Comics, Superman and Batman. The Legion one is, it's kind of an interesting... take on it. Like each one of there's like a panel with like a Legion character in each one of them, and it's using like it's almost like saying like you get like it's Paul Levis and Keith Giffen, and it's almost saying like you get like from the Legion you can get a sampling of everything from DC, because there's a panel that has the word adventure and it's written in the Adventure Comics font. There's a panel that says combat, and it looks like the GI combat. Mystery in space. There's a young love. There's one that says action, like in Action Comics. There's one that says detective, like in Detective Comics. So that's kind of an interesting approach. The Flash one is about it's about around the time of the trial of the Flash. So you got
what sampler was this from? What was it titled? DC Sampler what?
Just DC Sampler, and it came out in 1983.
83.
Yeah, it's got a big like it almost looks like a monitor tower, and it's got like the Titans all on one column, and then like on the other side of it, Superman, Green Lantern, Mega Men, Firestorm's like flying in the bottom. It's like a double page, like that's like a double cover. So if you like open it up on the back, Batman, Supergirl's on the back, Flash, Amethyst, Wonder Woman, Batman, Legion. There's just a few.
Yeah, that was actually, it's listed as number one. I guess they did samplers in 83,
84,
and
85. Okay. Yeah, Eric Son
of Thunder
is
in
here. And then finally, Firestorm is the very last one. Before that is Supergirl. And it's kind of funny, like, Supergirl's standing there with like her arms spread out, says, "It's me, all right. Or should I say the new me? How's the new outfit grab you?" And Superman says, "It's something, Kara. Something. I should have known, you stodgy old traditionalist. You're still pining for my original getup, aren't you? One modeled after your costume." And she's got like, it's the blue top of like a, with the red skirt, but the skirt's like ruffled.
Yeah, yeah.
And like the red of the super symbol actually kind of like extends the red over onto her shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of interesting, but cause she's had a lot of different costumes. But so that kind of wraps it up. I just thought it was really interesting. It's like something that I got for free in an order that I actually wanted to hang on to instead of just getting rid of.
That's very cool.
So yeah, it's kind of a cool piece of history to see. You know, back before you had the internet to rely upon and stuff, this is kind of how they advertised all the stuff. Yeah, see old school advertising from the 80s.
I actually have that because I looked it up in my database and I have all three.
Nice.
Yeah, that's good memories.
Yeah, yeah, it kind of brings a lot of different things to mind.
At that point in the time, I was going to the comic shop because I remember getting Arrak and Supergirl and...
Nice.
Did it say who the Legion creative team was at the time, or?
Yeah, it was Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, and Larry Malstedt. That's who's credited.
That was a good era for them.
Yeah, and it's actually the last panel of that is Bouncing Boy, and he's like stretching out, like it's almost like he's opening his shirt, but it says DC inside. He's like a circle. It's almost like he swallowed the DC logo or something. According to our readers, we haven't gone plop yet.
I can't remember who he's married to, but she's no joke. Fat. I don't know, but she's hot.
Wasn't it Triplicate Girl?
Yeah, I think it is.
I want to say, yeah.
I just remember saying, God, that guy's got it made.
Yeah. His lady can turn into three ladies.
Yeah, three ladies.
Pretty awesome.
So the next one I read, I'm not going to talk a lot about it because I thought it was disappointing. I continued my Avengers Beast hardcover, which I enjoyed the first story, but the second story I didn't like. It was 138, Avengers 138. Steve Englehart and George Tuska does the pencils, Vince Coletta on inks. And it continues the Stranger story, and it did get strange. Did get real strange. Wasp is in the hospital. Yellow Jacket is really angry, so he's starting to show his personality where he's just kind of losing it. Mm. They decided to divide in teams to go search for the Stranger. It seems like everybody wants to team up with Moondragon. Thor makes it a point to say that they're not members yet, Moondragon and Beast, but they're trying out. Like, he makes it a point to say that. The people seem, like the public seems really angry that they allowed a mutant, like Beast, in the team. And they're like, who's this bald lady? Who's this bald lady? What's she doing on the team? Why is she wearing this skimpy outfit? Because she does have like a bikini-like outfit, bald lady, with a cape. Yeah. The thing I didn't like about this issue is they kind of like beefed up the Stranger. So I'm like, oh, this could be a cool fight scene between the Stranger. Well, it turns out that the Stranger wasn't the Stranger. It was Toad, from the X-Men.
Yeah.
And that's where it got really effed up. they ended up defeating the Toad, and I really didn't like it. I liked the beginning much more than the ending when they revealed the Toad. I was like, "What? How's the Toad being the Stranger?" And it just wasn't even a good explanation. I didn't even remember.
Pretty anticlimactic.
Yeah, anticlimactic. But I'll jump into the next story because I want to finish this hardcover, which is 139, where the Whirlwind's attacking the Wasp because she's still in the hospital. And I've always liked the Hank Pym and the Janet storyline, so I think I'll enjoy that one issue a lot more.
Yeah.
It wasn't a badly written story, it just the plot didn't do it for me. What else you got?
Actually, you can wrap us up with your other one.
All right.
I mentioned everything I wanted to.
So that was Avengers 139 or whatever. I can't remember. No, it was 138. The last one, which I could be quick about, is my independent choice, and it also came from a hardcover, but it was Ninjak number 1 and 2.
Ah, nice.
I had gotten the hardcover from Valiant, which is reprinting it, and I didn't remember a lot of the Ninjak. Like, Valiant's one of my favorite universes, and I knew Ninjak, you know, was the spy guy, and he's fighting the web. He's part of the Weaponeers, which they actually supply weapons to various groups, and he's working for that Alucard guy, and the interesting thing is the art for this. This is Jimmy Palmiotti doing the inks over Joe Quesada. So the art is really, really nice. I mean, very different from Valiant, I think, at the time, which if you looked at Valiant books, it wasn't like looking at an Image book. Like an Image book, you'd see different styles. You'd go from Eric Larson to Todd McFarlane to Jim Lee to Rob Liefeld, very different styles. Whereas it seemed like the Valiant books tried to mimic the same type styles. Do you know what I mean? All kind of look very similar. Well, this looked very different. The interesting things I want to point out here is that Ninjak is trying to take out Dr. Silk. And he runs across this woman that's one of the Dr. Silk spies, and one thing that's interesting about him is she ends up betraying this another guy, a French guy. She betrays him. She works for Dr. Silk, and then she goes and she sleeps. In other words, she sleeps with everybody. And Ninjak knows this and decides to sleep with her before he takes her down, because she is hot. I mean, I'll give her that. But Dr. Silk is really creepy looking. He's like in a wheelchair. Deathly ill, looks like all these tubes going in him, just barely keeping him alive, but he's a bastard, man. He just kills anybody. They wheel him around. He kills this one dude by with the Black Widow spiders. He puts some Brazilian plant extract on him that the spiders are real attracted to, and then just dumps a bunch of Black Widows on top of him, and kill him that way. But
yeah, because that would be a nightmare for some people.
In the second issue, he takes out Dr. Silk. At least you think he does. And it gets involved with the United States of America. Ninjak manipulates the United States to attack Dr. Silk's hideout, to nuke it, basically blast the hell out of it. And they make you think that Dr. Silk is dead after the end of the second issue, but I don't think he's dead. But it was fun. I'm going to probably finish this one maybe this week, and maybe just wrap up what it is.
Now, I know Ninjak has come back in the new Valiant in Exo Manowar. Do you think he'll end up with his own book at some point?
Oh, yeah. I think that'll be the next release. I think that's why they did this hardcover. That's what they tend to do.
Yeah,
they release the hardcover and then the other book comes out. So, matter of fact, I just read Exo number 5 where he first appeared, and it's very similar to his first appearance in the original environment. you know, when he was hired to take out Bloodshot.
Mm-hmm.
This one, in the new Valiant, he's hired to take out XO.
Yeah.
Because the spider aliens don't want him in his armor. And in the current continuity, he takes out XO pretty easy. He finds Arak outside of his armor and just throws a star at him that has a poison in it to knock him out. And
yeah.
Takes his armor. He's a pretty badass guy. It's cool book. If you haven't checked out the original Ninjak, it's worth a look see. And the one thing that I have on the issue one is it had a beautiful, what do they call it? Those like covers that they used to come out with that like Turok had. They were like those shiny acetate or whatever covers or.
Was that like holograph or chrome or?
Yeah, chromium. They're chromium covers. I love the chromium covers. Age of Ultron did it just recently. Did like a chromium type cover.
Oh yeah.
The story was mediocre. Cover was pretty cool. The art was nice.
So does it reproduce it in the trade or?
Yeah, on this hardcover.
Yeah.
But doesn't reproduce the cover. It reproduces what the cover looked like, but it's not. Yeah. The thing I like about the hardcovers of the old Valiant is it's very much the paper quality of the Jack Kirby omnibuses.
Mm-hmm.
I like that paper. I love that paper. I love that paper. I don't like the shiny paper. I don't like it. And this doesn't have the shiny paper, but it's really thick. And it's like paper. I like it.
Yeah, I kind of like it too. I sort of like the matte look.
It makes the art look better. The light doesn't shine off the paper to take away from the art.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great paper. I mean, if you want to explore Valiant, I recommend going for these card covers. They're well worth it.
Cool.
They're put together really nicely.
Yeah, I'd like to read some Valiant at some point since I didn't really. And I've been that's what I've been doing a lot lately is going back and reading like the 80s and 90s stuff that I didn't bother with or whatever when I was kid.
I want to post some of these, I want to tweet some of these things and I'll put you in the tag name from the art that's in the Superman versus Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it'll freak you out how good it is. I mean, like, it's really good. It reminds me of Perez. And then I want to also show you what, like, Quesada's art looked at the time because this art looks really great to me. I don't know if it's Palmiotti's ink. I know Palmiotti inked a lot of Quesada stuff, but this is, like, a really dark tone, and it looks mm-hmm. very different. It doesn't look like his Azrael. It looks very, very unique. And then I wanted to just mention briefly, I know this is a retro cast, but I wanted to see if you've read two books that I thought were really good lately. Have you read Todd, the Ugliest Kid on Earth?
No, you know, and I almost ordered that.
God, it's so good. The art style and stuff so different from anything I've ever seen. It's mm-hmm. very dark. It's very cool story. Highly recommend that one. And then the other one I'll recommend is Five Weapons. Oh man, that is good.
Yeah, I didn't order that one either. Those are both Image though, right?
Yeah, they were just like 5 out of 5 like blew me away type titles.
Who did Five Weapons? Because I remember
The guy from Pompeii, Jimmy Robinson.
Oh, okay.
And this is more like an all-ages title, so he's exploring new ground, because Bomb Queen is pretty raunchy.
Yeah.
But if you listen to the latest Geek Brunch, we don't give it away,
mm-hmm.
but all three of us loved it. Like, and we don't normally agree on everything. Like, Bill gave it 5 out of 5. I gave it 5 out of 5. Micah was reading it while we were talking about it. So, it's a good book, really good book. It's about a school of assassins with a really cool twist. It's like a flawless number one. You know, like we couldn't like point out one thing he did wrong. Like he just it was so good. And same with the Todd, the ugliest kid on earth. It's just exceptional.
That's pretty high praise, because I mean, Micah especially doesn't seem to read as much these days.
Me and Bill have similar tastes, but Bill doesn't go mainstream a lot. You know what I mean?
Right.
Skims the outskirts.
Right.
And we don't always see eye to eye on stuff, but we do usually with the Avatar stuff, and stuff. But Micah's very different, and he enjoyed it a lot. So cool. Yeah, worth checking out if you can find it.
Yeah.
I know you can find it digitally if you read it off your iPad, but
right, yeah.
I read Todd the Ugliest Kid on Earth on the iPad because Bill talked about it, and also Daryl had talked good things about it, and it was fantastic. I mean, it was. I had to read it digitally because if you want to buy it, it's like $16 on eBay. You know, there's only like 2,000 copies out there. It's too late for me to try to read it in print.
Yeah, it's tough with the image stuff because every month there's new number ones, and sometimes they catch on, sometimes they don't. And the ones that do usually end up on eBay real quick because there's such low print runs. People start hearing word of mouth that it was good and they want to get it, you know. I think we talked about this on Twitter, that I decided to go ahead and sell my Thief of Thieves number one. I think I got it from like DCBS probably for $2.
Yeah.
Sold it for like 70 something.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I'm getting so tempted to do it, even though I haven't read the damn thing yet. But I have a more of a psychological disorder of parting with my comics. So it's, I could just get over it because really what I want to do is just read it. I don't want to read it digitally, though, because I'm still psychologically, I don't get the same experience digitally as I do on paper.
I don't mind reading digitally, but if I have the choice, I read paper.
Yeah, maybe it's because we work on computers all day. Do you know what I mean?
That's part of it, and also, like, you know, sense memory. I mean, how I grew up reading comics. I associate, you know, it's just what I want from the experience, you know?
Yeah.
But I can. I mean, I do read digital sometimes. I don't mind it. I have a preference, you know?
Right. And one other thing is, I know Trenchcoat Mafia from Podcast X wants to be on, so I'm going to try to get him on next time.
Okay.
I'll just tell him he just wants to know what books we're reading, and I'll just give him the next three, you know, Jack Kirby, Fourth World, and then the rest we just read on our own anyway.
Right. Sure, and I mean, if for some reason we have a guest and they don't have the Fourth World stuff and they just want to come on,
then we could do the other part first and then finish
right
the Fourth World, and they can stay if they like.
Yeah, if they want to.
Right.
You know, so.
And we got one last minute question. I thought we'd end on this note and then it's from Mark McGraw, and he has, what is Jack Kirby's greatest contribution to the DCU? He says, be specific, not just the Fourth World. You're kind of working your way, experiencing it for the first time, right?
Yeah.
So I guess you'd have to base it on what you've read so far.
But I gotta say Darkseid.
Yeah, I guess his overall contribution, like, that's definitely his biggest contribution to the DCU.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at what's, at least, I guess the way I'm thinking of it is what has proven to be the most, like, the creation that people are the most interested in, like, picking up and using. I mean, he's been at the center of a lot of different events. I mean,
he's been in the New 52.
New 52.
Everywhere as the big bad. He's been in Legion.
Legion, that's a very... The Great Darkness saga, that's a very famous storyline, you know. And Final Crisis is, like, regardless of what you think of it, was, you know, was their crossover event for that year. And
impacted animation. He's rumored to be the Justice League villain in the movie.
So I would say probably he's pretty big. Secondaries maybe... I mean, I think the demon has shown to be used a lot. I think also not so much like Omak himself, but the whole Brother Eye Omak concept, the way that it's like that it was taken and used.
Yeah, yeah.
Batman and you know, and in the Crisis and stuff.
I think Omak's growing. Pre-Crisis, it became the Satellite Batman, and then pre-52, you know,
right.
The Satellite Batman, and then it became, you know, where any human could become an OMAC, like it was taking over people.
Right.
They're destroying things, and then OMAC became what it is today in the New 52, which I'm loving. And even prior, I would say OMAC was my biggest... I would say my biggest contribution, if we're talking at a personal level, the first 8 issues of OMAC probably impacted me the most, because it visually and story-wise just blew me away conceptually how advanced it was for its time. Mm-hmm. But I'll agree with you, Darkseid is probably the most impacting to the DCU as a whole. Like,
yeah.
If you're talking about DCU as a whole, not personally. But I would also say, followed by that, is Mr. Miracle. I think he's been...
True.
He's been around. He's had, like, 5 titles. They don't run very often, but...
He could probably be number 2, actually. Yeah.
They seem to keep him in the limelight, and then they put him in the Justice League International, you know?
Right,
Had a good run.
Yeah, the Justice League International connection, I think, is what maybe would make him like two, because that was pretty. That's, you know, a classic and big part of pre-52 DC. Was that run?
Yeah, and so. Demon, like you said, I'd agree. And then just like Orion, he's had his own book. He's always been the forefront character in the New Gods titles.
Yeah.
So he's probably coming in on a 4th, but I definitely rate Demon as the 3rd. Mm. Commandy's probably in there somewhere, but he's off in his own world mostly.
Top 10, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, he was in Wednesday Comics and.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
I'm hoping they do something with that in the New 52, like. And God, I would love to see Giffen and Koblish on that.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Like, I'm going to get that He-Man one. They're doing a one-shot. It's Giffen and Koblish doing the art on it. And I haven't been getting the He-Man one-shots, but I am going to get that one. It's like some character I never even heard of, like Heidrich or Heidick, or I don't even know what it is. I just saw it in the new previews.
Yeah, they should. I'd rather did the Commandy personally. I liked He-Man when I was a kid, but I personally can't get into it as an adult.
Yeah. So yeah, those are. I'm sure there's something we're missing, but.
Hasn't
really taken off. I mean, they have him and the Guardian show up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Yeah. So, well, that was a good one to wrap it up on. Start with Kirby, end with Kirby.
Yep. You can reach us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. At MythMakingETC. Send him questions, too. You could send him questions on Twitter. And I'm at Mike Myers Brunch. I usually ask for them.
Yeah,
I don't usually get them because people volunteer the question. I usually ask for them, and I surprisingly got more than I thought we were going to get this time.
Yeah. You're Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter. And
our Facebook page.
Like us on Facebook. And you can send emails to Mike@comicbooknoise.com. And I'm mythmakingetc@gmail.com. What else? Forums, forumforgeeks.com. You can scroll down to Geek Brunch and check out the forums there. Mike's keeping track of the movies and comic books he reads every week. And
yeah, somebody else participated. His name is Paul. He put his list. He's very much like Bill. He's put a lot of indie stuff. I didn't see one Marvel or DC that was red.
Nice. I think that might be it.
Yeah, Paul usually gives us comments too on the Facebook page, so thank you for providing feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely appreciate anyone that likes the show. Or yeah, if you visit iTunes and you want to give us a review there,
you could still be the first.
Yeah, to mention the Retrocast specifically. You can make Bill and Micah jealous. And I think that's about it.
All right. We'll be talking some Forever People and Superman. I think it's a Superman's pal and New Gods next time.
Oh, yeah, that reminds me. Did you... So, in Volume 2, we have 1, 2, 3, 4... We got 5 issues left.
Yeah.
So, we could do... If we do 3 next time, we'll have 2 left in this volume.
Do you have the next volume?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I guess we can just decide when the time comes if we want to, you know, jump over to the next volume and do the first one.
When that time comes, we could just complete the volume and start with the brand new volume. Yeah.
There's some, because we could talk about stuff that's like, there's some extra stuff in the back. There's an afterword and there's a bunch of sketch pages.
Yeah, this one had a lot more behind the scenes stuff on this one.
Yeah, there's a bunch of Kirby's pencils and stuff, so we can take a look at those.
So. Did I tell you that I read I'm getting the Kirby Collector, and it had a really interesting article about I know this we're going over, but this will just take two seconds to mention. It had an interesting article because it had the only 3 available scripts that Stan Lee ever did. One was with a reporter in the room, and then what Kirby did with them. I mean, like, one was Fantastic Four number 1, one was a Silver Surfer issue, and one was a later issue. And the one with the reporter was the most interesting that they had in there because Stan Lee, like, said 4 lines. And it was an Alicia Silver Surfer and Thing issue. I want to go read it now because I have the omnibus, so I could go read that issue and maybe spotlight it on this show to see how much of the story Kirby told. Like, I know the 3 lines that Stan Lee said, and I want to see what, you know, just curiosity, what the story turned out to be and how much of Kirby added to it. Yeah. I know on the first issue of Fantastic Four, he had given away, like, the origin. It was an origin issue, obviously, so he plotted that and then gave it to Kirby, and then Kirby just ran with it. But it was a very cool... The Kirby Collector, I'd recommend for anybody interested in just Kirby. Like, it just focuses on him, and it gives original artwork, like, before it's inked and stuff. So if you're interested in seeing Kirby before inks, I'd highly recommend the Kirby Collector. And I'm late to the show, man. I'm extremely late to the show, but I make it my bathroom book, and I read it, and I really enjoy it. Like, it had Black Panther original sketches and stuff before they went with the original design, and there's some crazy outlandish designs there, but it's a fascinating book. It really is.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool.
Tomorrow's Publishing. Well, have a good one, Chris. Thanks for letting me run a little bit over.
Thank you for
leaving feedback and giving us questions to talk about. Gives us more to explore in the show.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate
it. Have a good one, Chris.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
I don't think so. I'll see when I get there. I hope they're prepared for the Prince of Bel-Air.